Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, high schools are back in business. We'll get your day two thoughts. Then 9 fully vaccinated members of the Yankees, 1 player and 8 staffers, tested positive for COVID-19. Only 1 person showed symptoms. And while the outbreak might be shocking on face value, it is a real-world example of the vaccines actually protecting against severe illness. Sports Authority Trina Kuznarek will join us.
The pandemic has lifted the curtain on vast disparities in our healthcare system. A new documentary from Frontline and NPR examines how market forces and unsteady government support are deepening the healthcare divide. Some hospitals are booming financially, while many safety net hospitals are struggling to stay afloat. NPR correspondent Laura Sullivan will join us to discuss the healthcare divide. That and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, did you hear Henry's news a couple of seconds ago?
I did.
He's talking about me. I can't rent a place for the last 2 weeks on the Cape for the first time in 30 years. I can't rent a car. My car's in the shop. I'm like totally
what are you
screwed
gonna do?
Here.
Well, you'll have to do a staycation right there in Cambridge, Jim.
Yeah, okay, fine. In any case, hi, Marjorie.
Hello.
Just as the school year is coming to a close, high schools have reopened for full-time in-person learning. As you know, yesterday, 99% of Massachusetts high schools opened up. A handful of schools have been granted waivers to delay the full-time return or to keep a hybrid model. And parents can still choose, meaning individually, to have their kids learn remotely. We're taking your calls asking, what does this mean for your teens? Are they looking forward to going back to school? Has a year of remote learning been a sanctuary? Will adjusting to the return to classroom be another steep learning curve to conquer? Or is this the best thing to happen to your kids since we went into lockdown? The number's 877-301-8970. We want to hear from teachers, too, and parents, etc. And it's not just, even if you don't have a kid in a high school thing where he or she is returning, or maybe they were already back kind of thing, or maybe you're keeping home remotely. To me, it also, it sort of completes the circle on schools. Everybody is back now, except those few still doing the remote thing. And, you know, in many ways, it's more an indication of a return to semi-normalcy. And I say semi because it's the end of the semester, and there's this huge learning loss issue. I was about to say, even more than Governor Baker's announcement, he'll be with us Thursday, by the way, Governor Baker's announcement about May 29th, sort of the school thing, which was central to almost every hot debate we had on the show over the last 14 months. It's sort of, as I say, the circle is completed. We want to know what you think about it, particularly if you have kids in high school. And if you don't, we'd love to talk to you too. 877-301-8970. What's your reflection as another parent whose kids are long out of high school?
Well, I haven't had any children home harassing me. Well, actually, they were living with me for a while, so I guess that's not true. They were harassing me, grown children that they were. But as I said a million times, I cannot imagine how difficult this year has been for teachers trying to teach on Zoom, trying to teach kids in the classroom, how difficult this has been for parents, particularly mothers, who end up having to be the educators as well as doing everything at home, and in many cases having to lose their own jobs.
How about the kids? Did you read about that Chelsea kid? You see the photograph of the Chelsea kid in the Globe yesterday in bed?
Grades went down. Yeah, her grades went down from B's and C's to a couple of D's. She's
horrible. She's,
on the other hand, she taught, and she's going back to school and hoping she can improve her grades because working at home has been really, really hard for her. But she said on one of her good friends, whose mother and uncle had a terrible battle and tussle with COVID-19, and traumatizing her, she's not keen on going back to school, and you can understand why.
Doesn't feel safe, you mean?
Yeah, and the kids just started to get the 12 to 15 year olds have just begun receiving their vaccines. I mean, a lot of kids in high school are older than that, but you know, 16, 17, and 18 year olds, and so
well, we
I
have
think
to
it's
be
a mixed bag.
But just be clear. When we're talking about the unmasking of Massachusetts, the announcement yesterday from Governor Baker, kids and faculty and staff in the schools inside still have to have masks on. So this is not a free-for-all come return, both now and I assume in the fall, unless the governor changes his perspective in the next couple of months. 877-301-8970. I can't even articulate what I was trying to say a minute ago. This, to me, is a really important moment. What I guess I was trying to say is, of all the conversations we have with listeners about the pain of the pandemic, other than the illnesses and deaths themselves, obviously, which are just unimaginable, the pain that was caused to kids and their parents, as you say, by this remote learning, which no one was prepared for, was probably the most intense discussions we had with listeners over the past year, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we're going to talk later in the show with Dr. Ken Duckworth about the depression and the anxiety and the mental health toll this has taken. People just feeling just kind of totally out of it. So I think it's great. And, you know, youth sports, too, they're not going to have to wear masks in youth sports this spring. So that's very nice, right? You can go outside and do your outdoor sports, baseball team, soccer team, et cetera.
You know what's also even better?
Lacrosse in the spring? I'm not sure.
I don't know. You know what the best thing is? The one-month semester. That's the. If I was a kid, I mean, you know, as much as I want to go back and see my friends, the fact that you go back in mid-May, I mean, we know some high schools obviously were back already, and then you're done in June. Again, the summer school, we talked to Brenda Caselius, the superintendent of the Boston Public Schools. I think she said she hopes that as many as 50% of the kids will make use of whatever summer school offerings they have. It's not just getting them back in school now, which I think is huge. It's what they're going to do about the damage that was done, not just psychological, as you talked about, but learning over the past year. 877-301-8970.
And you know what else? I mean, for many people, you know, that those last weeks in high school where you were either going to graduate, go to college, go into service, you know, go get a job, whatever you're going to do, were fantastic weeks, right? You had all that partying that went on. Yeah. You had graduation. You had proms. You had all this great stuff that went on. So let's hope there's some sort of semi-normal return of that kind of thing. I don't know what everybody's going to do for graduations, but to miss that, as these kids did last year, was tough. Anyway,
by the way, one last thing before we get to the calls. What? I would be remiss doing this. Our colleagues at GBH have done this fabulous series following a bunch of high school seniors for the whole year. It's called COVID and the Classroom.
It's great.
And it is just, you should Google it, go to the GBH site. We're going to be playing another segment from it, I think, tomorrow night on Greater Boston. It really is an intimate look at what the lives of these terrific, terrific kids have been like and what would have, well, what has been their senior year in school. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Worcester with Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
We're good.
Can you hear me okay?
We can.
All right. So I'm calling. I'm a mom of two elementary school kids, but I am also a pediatrician. So I have been seeing, you know, quite a lot of teenagers coming in for, like, their well check. Parents calling a lot about, like, the moods. The moods are so all over the map. I mean, I have kids that are chomping at the bit, cannot wait to get back to sports, are dying to see their friends in person and all that, and others that are like, I never want to go back to school again, you know, now that they've seen remote school and, like, it's an option. Like, it was never an option for all my, like, kids with school phobias and just anxieties and things, and now they're like, they've seen that side, I guess, and they're like, I feel like it's going to be pulling teeth to drag them back into the classroom. Like, it's a total mix.
You know, Amanda, I've been fascinated by this, the number of emails we've gotten and calls we've gotten from parents who are talking about exactly that their kids, either their kids were bullied in school or their kids had social issues relating to the other kids, who are thrilled. I'm wondering how prevalent you see that in your practice. Is this common?
Yes. Wow. I would say it's pretty common. Yep. I mean, and even kids without any, like, obvious source, you know, like a bullying, a peer pressure, you know, some major negative event or anything. Just, I think just being in class, just intrinsic shyness and things like that. Like, I have kids that have struggled so hard, like solid CD students that are on the honor roll since they've been remote because they feel, like, so free to, like, speak up and, like, answer and, like, just not be in the classroom. They've got their, like, camera turned off because they've got, like, the Zoom phobia, but... And they're, like, thriving. So it's like looking at two totally different worlds, depending on the kid. It's
Amanda,
really weird.
don't go away. I'll do my weekly imitation of Marjorie Egan. I am not a pediatrician. I think most of the listeners knew that, and you are. The thing that concerns me, I am sympathetic to that, and if I had a kid still in high school who got a sanctuary from any pain that they were suffering in high school, I'd be celebrating it too. But being at home and being able to avoid pain is not the real world. Ultimately, you got to return to the world in which some people aren't treating you kindly. Some people are actually bullying you. So it's a respite. It's surely not a cure. I mean, obviously you'd agree with that, right?
Oh, I agree, definitely. I mean, it's just so hard to see the kids that, like, I'm like, oh, how's this year been? They're like, great. And I'm like, oh, boy. You know, yeah. It's like, this is not, you know, like you said, the real world. Like, this is not how it's going to be forever. Even my elementary kids, I was, like, you know, doing cartwheels when they went back to school 5 days. And and they were like, oh, like, in-person school? And I was like, yeah, like school. Like, it's been every
like
other
school,
year.
Like school, right?
Cool, you know, and they're like, oh, but like, I kind of liked going on YouTube when my class let out early. And I'm like, cool, but that's not school. You're going back. Like,
yeah.
Amanda, we're really glad you called. School. Stay in touch with us, will you, as the year goes ahead. Good luck with your kids and the people you're treating, too. Boy, pediatrician's a pretty tough job right now.
Yeah, but when you think about that, I mean, there's a lot of cruelty and clickiness, and you're in, you're out, you're in school. Kids can be pretty cruel.
I'm not denying that. I hope I wasn't being insensitive.
No, you weren't.
But
you weren't
staying
at all.
Home doesn't solve the problem. It solves the problem in the short term.
But sometimes you're better equipped when you're older to deal with that kind of stuff.
I don't know.
I think about even in your school, you know, or my school a million years ago. I mean, there were some kids that were pretty brutalized.
I'm saying is what I said to Amanda, the pediatrician, is the goal is to figure out how to deal with that and minimize that damage in the real world. And as she said, school is not sitting in your bed, even though I'm sympathetic to it, with a computer in your lap. School is school. Thanks for the call, Amanda. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
This is an email from Jen. She says, I have a senior daughter at Tech High School, a bit of an introvert, concerned about COVID more than being at school. Her grades have been excellent, but we have been her structure. She became an expert at virtual everything, including virtual college interactions. She found the single weeks of on-site exhausting after 3 weeks after it being virtual, and her school allowed her to remain on a one-third schedule, which she appreciated. So she's going to finish the year without any changes.
Who does that sound like? When she said she found the week on campus exhausting, who does that sound like?
You.
You and me. Is when we do go into Guest Street, which we're doing more and more, we end the day like we've been tortured. You know, it's when you're used to a certain lifestyle, which in our case has been a benefit because we've gotten paid for this whole thing, it's hard to go back to what
now
was. There's another Jen. Let's take another Jen.
Yeah, we'll take another call.
On hold. Jen and well, maybe it's the same Jen. I don't know. Hi, Jen from Arlington.
Hi. It's not the same Jen.
Good. Hi.
So I'm a first-time caller. I have senior who I caught the end of when Marjorie was talking about proms and graduations, and she goes to public high school and really wasn't in person until last week. She went back full-time last week with all of the students. And they are doing a prom. They've kind of managed to figure out a 150-person prom on the turf for 2 hours.
Wow.
So they're going to have two proms. My daughter was saying last night, it's the night before, it's May 28th, so the restrictions are being lifted on the 29th. And she was like, I'm going to call Governor Baker and just ask him if the other 90 kids could go. Because it's so unfair. And I was like, go for it.
Absolutely.
You know? And they are having a graduation. It's kind of unclear how many family members can go. But I would say for her this year has been a mixture of awful and pretty good. So I love
having
her.
What's the awful and what's
around.
The pretty good, Jen?
Well, I would say the awful was missing her friends and missing the social interaction. She's a pretty social kid. The pretty good was having her around during the day. I've been home working, so I got to spend time with her that I haven't had in a really long time.
Yeah.
I guess another good has been that she's become closer with the two kids that she's been hanging out with during the year. It's been hard to look at colleges, for sure. We did look at colleges. I kept saying, okay, now imagine 20 times the number of kids here. So there's definitely, even though she could walk around the schools and see the schools, it was a, it's not what it's going to be next year.
Hey, so, Jen, can I make a suggestion? I can't promise you this.
Yeah.
But yours is, your kid's question and the call she intends to make to the governor is a great one. If you send us an email and say question for Governor Baker in the subject line, we will do our best to squeeze it in to our conversation with the governor. He's joining us on Thursday. So either if you or your kids send us an email with the details of what she would be asking him, we'll try to ask for
That's
her
right.
If you
we'll
want.
Say we got an impassioned plea on behalf of Jen's kid.
One day
to
off.
Expand
hey,
the
Jen,
prom.
It was a great first call. Good luck with your kid and thanks. Call us again. We appreciate it. And do send that email. 877-301-8970.
Here's from Jackie. I have three kids, one in high school, two in middle school. They returned full time a few weeks ago here in the Cape. Immediate improvement in their academic performance, really? But also their emotional well being. The hybrid model, extremely difficult. And they're getting they're on the way to getting vaccinated. But Jackie says the same thing Jen just did, that she misses them. She loved having them home, but she's happy they're getting back for themselves. But she liked
We've heard
them
that from a lot of parents in this past year, by the way, is that the downside, actually getting yet another opportunity, which you haven't had in years, to spend time with your kid.
No, you know how it is with teenagers, Jim. I mean, they can spend their entire adolescence locked in their bedroom. They make them down for dinner for a few minutes with their phone. You have to argue about getting off the phone. You know, the only time you have a chance to talk to the kids when they're locked in the car with you, right? You have to drive to New Hampshire so you can have a conversation.
But let's not rhapsodize about this, because I'm assuming your kids are not listening to the show today.
They're
when
not.
Marjorie's kids would be home from college, she'd call me and I'd say, how's that? She said, it's great, but then you could hear her pause to make sure they weren't listening. I cannot wait till they go back to school. I mean, it's finite, right?
I love my children.
I didn't
Let's
say,
just be
of course
clear.
You do.
But it is a lot, especially when you're used to not having them around, to have them suddenly come back. But in the teen years, when all they want to do is hide from you, it's maybe kind of nice to have them around more, because then they're kind of trapped. Dave from Smithfield, Rhode Island. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Dave.
Hi, long time, first time.
Thank you, thank you.
We have a gamut in our house. My wife is a school psychologist.
Ooh.
Our oldest daughter is a college sophomore. Our oldest son is a senior in high school. He's graduating from Smithfield in next month. And our youngest is in seventh grade, so he's in middle school.
Yikes.
And it's been an interesting gamut for us, because our daughter, when everything hit last year, it was her first year of college, and it just destroyed her. She was not prepared for this. She became a massive introvert. She normally wasn't.
Oh, jeez.
All of it. Basically, she ended up failing three semesters in a row because of the mix between being in class remote and then being confined to her dorm. She didn't have roommates that she liked and got along with. So it just became a nightmare for her. So she ended up taking this semester off to kind of get herself back on track. Our oldest son, who plays cross country and plays track, and he's actually one of the better kids in the state and one of the best kids in our town program.
Good for him.
He's loved it, and it's actually, he's blossomed in all of this between going back and forth between remote and in school. He actually just got accepted to LSU, and we're getting ready to go take a trip. They just opened up doing the beyond campus visit, so we're getting ready to go do that with him. And then our youngest, he has an IEP that forced him to have to go into school full time. For him, it's been a battle, because when they've had close contacts, he's had to then isolate. So when he then has to work remotely, it doesn't work for him. Working in school, he stays on top of everything. He has a special ed teacher that works with him on a daily basis that keeps him kind of moving forward, because he has ADHD, so he struggles with keeping on track, keeping focused, keeping organized. So he has someone daily to help him. When he's remote, he all that goes out the window. So it's been a completely different experience for each kid.
How about, hey Dave, you're
three
leaving
completely different levels.
By the way, for those who don't have kids, IEP is Individualized Education Plan, but you're leaving two people of the household out of the discussion. How have you and your wife cope with this?
We're important. Not to the teenagers, we're not.
How's it going, really, for you two?
Yeah, it's so for myself, I work for a financial services firm, and pretty much everyone's worked remotely, but I'm someone who enjoys working in the building. So it's been difficult because I spend like my office is in our bedroom. So I'm spending roughly 18 hours a day in a 10-by-12 room. And especially when everybody's home, I then have to shut the door. So I'm locked in here. So it's actually, I'm chomping at the bit to get back to work, but I'm not eligible to go back for, I had a heart attack last summer. So I'm not eligible to get back into the office. Cause they won't, they're like, you're too much of a medical risk. And then for my wife, she's had that like that back and forth where she had certain days where she was doing remote. She was remote fully at one point, but then she's a Massachusetts school psychologist. And then she started going back in where they were going in like 4 days a week. And then one day a week she was working remotely. She actually really enjoyed that because that gave her time on that day to really focus and to not schedule meetings necessarily. But it's been difficult for her too, because she's balancing between, she can't have in-person meetings with a lot of parents and other faculty members.
Sure.
She has to do things remotely through Zoom. She can't do a lot of testing through Zoom. They have to do the testing in person with students because of obviously the concerns around a student being, you know, not so much cheating, but
no, I understand.
But changing,
you know, Dave,
the results.
Can I make a suggestion? You know, after hearing about the five members of your family, you should contact Netflix and do a reality series. I mean, that is, you've had one hell of a year. It's, I wish you, by the way, it was a great first call, and we're glad you shared your family story. And good luck to your couple of kids who are having a hard time adjusting with this. But really appreciate you sharing that story, and good luck to you all. Dave from Smithfield.
Here's an interesting email from Cassandra, an occupational therapist and special educator in Boston. She said she wants to say learning loss is a false construct. When I hear that term, I get frantic. Our children did not lose learning. They lost family members and lost time with friends. The most important thing to focus on is their mental health. If they're not okay, they can't absorb learning. The curriculum will come. The academic progress will come. What they learned was resiliency and adaptability. About family time, and we hope they learned how to cook or clean or build. They grew their adversity muscles. An interesting perspective from someone who teaches in the schools. We also seem to have a lot of people with a kind of a dim view of school in general. Jim, listen to this from Manny in East Providence. School is rife with clickiness and politics and bullying and downright meanness. But then, so are the majority of workplaces where these youngsters are supposed to be preparing to go to. So there you go.
Is he talking about Microsoft with Bill Gates, or who is that person talking about? We should just say, since so many of the callers and emailers, and we're going to take a quick break in a second, have talked about their kids' heads as well as their kids' schooling, I want to repeat what Marjorie said. Dr. Ken Duckworth,
yes,
who not only works for Blue Cross Blue Shield here, but as the medical director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is going to join us in the 1 o'clock hour to talk about these very issues. So for those who have concerns about such things, I hope it's everybody, please make sure you stay with us.
Okay, we are still talking about schools for the next few minutes, I believe, Jim.
Yep. We are.
Everybody, or most everybody, being back to school anyway. Your reactions, parents, teachers, kids, 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about high schools reopening full-time. That's as of yesterday, about 99% of them in-person learning. Asking you, are you ready? Are your kids ready? Is your community ready? Does going back to school alleviate anxiety, or does it create new ones to worry about? 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Carrie on the highway. Thanks for calling, Carrie.
Hello, Carrie.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, first of all, we listen to you all the time in our house, so
thank you
so much for taking our call.
Thank you.
So, ironically, we're listening to you as we're driving up 95, and my 15-year-old is sitting here with me, my very articulate 15-year-old honors student, who's getting her first vaccine.
Oh, great. Congratulations to her. That's great.
Thank you. She's very excited about that. But I just want to say, like, in our household, we're both working from home. distraction for parents, obviously. But generally, I think we've been a very lucky family. The perspective of my teenager might be different, but we haven't been directly affected by COVID. So we just learned to hunker down and enjoy our green space and, you know, make the best of it. But would she be able to talk to you guys about her perspective?
Absolutely. What's
We'd
her
love
name?
To.
Oh, okay. Here she is. Hold on.
What's her name?
My name is Charlotte.
Hi, Charlotte. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much. Can we start with the vaccine? How are you feeling about getting it, and how are your friends feeling about getting it or not?
I'm really excited because I want to be able to see people do things, just start living my life more.
Or do most of your friends feel the same way, or is there some hesitancy?
I feel like none of my friends are really hesitant, but some of the parents are hesitant about letting their kids get the vaccine because I feel like they don't have enough information.
Mm-hmm.
So, Carrie, what do you think about going back to school?
I'm excited.
Carrie. I called you your mother's name. Charlotte. Sorry. Charlotte, what do you think?
I'm really excited about it. My school's already gone back full in person, full hours. And it's so much easier to learn when you're in school rather than at home, because I know one of the biggest challenges for me at home was all the distractions, like my phone, my cat meowing, just being in a classroom setting, like a real classroom, helps me not have any of those distractions, because there's teachers and other kids that keep me from, like, going on my phone or playing, like, computer games.
Mm-hmm. Charlotte, we mentioned at the top of the segment, I don't know if you were listening, well, whether you were or not, the mandatory return to school on the statewide basis still allows individual parents to opt out and to let their kid do remote for the rest of the year. What percentage would you say of your classmates are still getting remote only learning?
Probably like one or two kids per class.
Oh, that's it.
Some don't even have any.
Well, that's good.
Hey, Sean, are you a senior? Junior?
I'm a freshman.
Oh, you're a freshman? Oh, okay. So you're not worried about graduation and the prom then yet. You don't have to worry about that.
So, Charlotte, one last thing. Did your mother not say a minute ago the year worked out really well? I think she said. And she said my kid may have a different perspective. Do you have a different perspective?
I mean, I think it didn't go well for everyone, but it went well for me, even though I wasn't a big fan of the whole remote learning thing. I'm better with being in the classroom, actually being there.
Yeah, I was too when I was your age. Hey, Charlotte, we're thrilled to talk to you. We're really glad your mother put you on the phone. Good luck this year, and call us again sometime. We love talking to kids in school. So
yeah,
we hope
congrats on the vaccine.
Give us a buzz. Yeah, enjoy the vaccine. Even if it's a little jab, it is a great moment. Charlotte, thanks so much for the call. Marjorie, when you were 15, could you call a radio show and have a coherent conversation?
Certainly, Jim. Absolutely.
Certainly not in my case. Certainly, Jim. I could. We have time for one more. Let's go to
Christine in Salem. Thank you for calling, Christine.
Hi, Christine.
Hi, guys. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Love those. Hi.
And right on. I'm a therapist. I'm an outpatient mental health therapist.
Oh, great.
And I work at Mass General up here in the North Shore, primarily with teenagers. And so the dramatic impact that this has had on them, I've seen directly. And I feel that the reintegration into school, was listening and talking to another therapist about how important it is for us all to go slowly and be mindful of the process. Kind of like if in scuba diving, when you're coming up from the bottom of the ocean, you need to go slowly. Otherwise, you get the bends, right? You'll explode or implode, whatever. You know. And I feel like it's the same way for our kids. They've gone through such a traumatic transition this whole year. And now we're like, yay, you're back. But we've got to be very mindful and encourage them to really listen to themselves. And if they're feeling uncomfortable and safe, that they speak up. And that they still continue to take precautions that they need to feel safe.
Yeah, but Christine, you know, we mentioned this. There was I don't know if you were listening. A pediatrician was one of our first callers and was talking about how in some cases this, she didn't use this word, but a kid staying home sort of a sanctuary for them if there's difficult stuff they're dealing with. And I sort of totally presumptuously tried to show sympathy, but said at the same time, the kids ultimately got to learn to deal with the stuff that happens in the real world, and your house and your bedroom are not the real world. Was I right, or am I oversimplifying?
Absolutely dead on. Oftentimes when my kids are talking about, why do I have to learn this particular thing in school? I'm not going to do this. I'm going into a different career. But it's the process of learning, right? It's the process of doing what you need to do that teaches us how to be in the world at large. And so for about 10%, 15% of my kids, I would say that this was actually a haven for them that had social anxiety and generalized anxiety, like big time, or were bullied in school. They're thrilled to be in the room. And so for them to get out of their bedroom, out of their bed and into the classroom, those are the kids that I'm the most concerned about at this time.
Christine, another first-time caller. We're really, really glad you called, and your work is so important, particularly now. Please call us again, and thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
So I guess, Jim, the conclusion is it's all over the map.
Well, it's all over the map, but, again, it's great we have Ken Duckworth today, the medical director of the National Alliance for the Mental Illness, and also Blue Cross Blue Shield here. How many of the calls mentioned the difficulty for kids transitioning? And think about it, by the way. You know, if a year out of your life, that woman who called yesterday was 79.
Right.
You know, that's one out of 80.
Yeah.
A year out of your life when you're 15 and you're sort of compass mentis at
Horrible.
Six or seven.
Horrible.
Exactly. It's a huge share of your young existence. So I get it. I mean, I get it as well as an older person can.
Okay, coming up, we're talking to our sports authority, Trenti Kuznarek. She's going to go over the latest sports headlines with us. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Join us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of sports and society and vaccines, actually, is Trenti Kuznarek. Trenti's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston. She's also a BPR contributor. Hello there, Trenti Kuznarek.
Hello, Trenti Kuznarek.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good morning.
Excellent.
You?
How are you?
I'm wonderful, thank you. It's like sunny and warm now.
I know. It's great. It's
easy
great.
To be in a good mood.
It is great.
Changes everything.
So, Trenti Kuznarek, let's start with the Yankees. A lot of people may know by now that eight people with connected with the Yankees have been vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but they got coronavirus anyway. Only one had symptoms. The rest were asymptomatic. But the Yankees are rethinking testing for COVID. What's the deal there?
Well, I don't know that they are rethinking it, but a doctor who spoke with Politico did say that maybe we should be rethinking testing in those cases. And I'll be honest, I don't quite understand that line of thinking, because to me, if you're testing, I mean, let's say you only have to have an 85% threshold on your team, right? So what if there's someone who is not vaccinated, who tests positive and is around other unvaccinated people, where we still know there is a risk factor, right? If you're vaccinated and you can track, what I think that I took away from this Yankees story was that vaccinations work. These
exactly.
guys were vaccinated. They contracted COVID somehow, but seven of eight of them had zero symptoms. And the one who did have symptoms had mild, like cold-like symptoms, not even flu-like symptoms. So to me, it shows that it works. But I do think that unless you have a 100% vaccination rate within, you know, because you're in such close contact, you should be monitoring those, especially who aren't vaccinated. But this doctor's point was, you know, it's causing unnecessary panic, right? Because what happened when this story came out, like everything else in the world now, it was split into two camps. There was a camp who was like freaking out. Oh, my God, you can still catch COVID. You can still have that. There were eight people. What happened? Why did this happen? And then there was another camp that said, no, this shows that vaccinations work. And I think this doctor's point is we do know they work. There's very minimal spread in any real like viral shed at all once you're vaccinated. So there's no point in doing it anymore because it causes like undue panic.
Well, you know, my sense.
I don't know if I agree with that, though.
Well, I do. First of all, if I understood
really?
It correctly, I understood it a little bit differently than you did. By the way, these cases after you're vaccinated are called breakthrough cases for those who have heard the term.
Thank you,
Jim. I thought what he was saying, and maybe you guys don't agree, is if you're vaccinated, don't test you. I don't think he's saying don't test people on teams or in groups of people who are unvaccinated. I think that continues to be pretty important. But the lesson, as you suggested, Trini, which is a really important and great one, is the viral load in people who are vaccinated apparently is so low, as evidenced by these Yankees. I think it's, what, one player and the rest staff, or a couple of players, whatever it is, mostly staff people.
Yeah.
They're not communicating it to somebody else. So I guess that's his notion, and I subscribe to that. We don't need more agony or confusion or whatever. Vaccines work. That's the bottom line. And yet another perk, as far as I'm concerned, is don't let them be tested. Which gets me to the story that puts me totally over the edge, is they're at that 85% threshold that Major League Baseball established, where you can, what Marjorie and I talk about all the time, incentives to get vaccinated. The
right.
good things that happen to you, about what you can do in the clubhouse, where you can eat out on the road and that sort of stuff.
Winning $1 million.
Exactly. And one, was that Ohio, right?
Yeah.
And one
of the, love that.
There's a lottery, right? But one of the teams that is not there, at least reading between the lines, doesn't sound like it's ever going to get there, are the Red Sox. What is up with this enlightened group of people?
You know, from what I understood, it was a little bit of twofold, right? The Yankees, it sounds like, accepted vaccinations in spring training. So even before maybe they were eligible in the state of New York, they accepted them while they were in spring training in Florida. So they got those a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. The Red Sox opted to wait until they were part of the eligible group. Similar to like, Governor Baker could have easily been one of the first people. He's front facing, he's around a lot of people, but Governor Baker chose to wait until his eligibility group came up. Waited his turn to get his vaccine. So the Red Sox opted to go that route. So that has delayed it in some sense. But what's concerning to me, Jim, is that they are not requiring players to become vaccinated. And there are some who just don't think they need it, especially at their, to the, you know,
Worcester.
Worcester, like the Worcester team, there's a lot of players who, exactly. And that's sort of, it's not so much of a taxi squad. Those are players that you know, when you have to make a call up, let's say there's a doubleheader or somebody gets injured and you need mm-hmm. to bring somebody up from the minors, you come up from Worcester. And so you also need those similar vaccination rates at your AAA affiliate where you're calling guys up, because they are then going to integrate with your major league. And listen, I know this is a touchy subject. You know, where I work, we have not yet I have not been asked my vaccination status. It has not been required, but it has been strongly, strongly suggested that you get vaccinated before we return to the office in full. We're going to do like a soft opening this summer. It's like a restaurant, with the expectation that we'll be back to full in-person operations by September. Now, I don't know if that's going to change. There might be a change in protocol that you have to get vaccinated. I'll be honest. I was sort of on the fence about it, Jim, but in terms of like, if you have to work in close contact, like you do in, you know, television, radio, you know, where you're talking a lot and there's a lot of aerosols being flown around and you're sitting at the same desk, if you're in a clubhouse, if you're in dugouts and stuff, like to me, I am starting to get to a point where I don't know that I have a problem with certain businesses requiring vaccinations for their employees.
Trina, you don't have enough time to listen to this show. We are the two biggest mandatory vaxxers in the United States of America. We are there. Trust me.
Yeah. And I was really on the fence about it at first, because I understand, like, first I was worried about vaccine equity, right? Like, can you reach people in rural places? I understand that there are certain, there are certain groups of people that I understand that there are people who don't trust medicine and the medical community the same way that I have been afforded to trust them for my entire life. But I do feel like now we have enough proof, we have enough data to show that these work and the difference it makes for people to be vaccinated, that like, I don't know if you guys have heard about this. This is totally sort of like off sports topic, but there's this cruise company that's doing a vaccination cruise this summer. So if you live in Boston, they're doing them, I think, on Saturdays and Sundays. And if you show your vaccine, you have to show proof of vaccination, but it's like, you can go maskless and you can do all these things. And it's going to be like a drag brunch on a boat, but it's like, only if you're vaccinated.
Yeah.
I can't wait to go on that because now I don't have to like have any concern at all about who's around me. But at the same time, I do understand, like, if I'm vaccinated and Jim's not, at least I am protected. And if you choose to not protect yourself, then I guess that's on you. I don't know, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting in this story. For a minute, I was mixing up my Martinez players because Pedro Martinez, the Hall of Famer, is the one that the MLB Association asked to help them with their pro-vaccine public service announcement. But this other guy that's quoted in this Peter Abraham story in
JD, the other
JD
guy.
Martinez. I was more familiar with Pedro than I am with JD. I'm not a huge baseball person. But in any case, he's an outfielder, I guess, and a designated hitter for the
great
Red Sox.
Designated hitter, yeah. Abraham
asked him about if it was important for the Red Sox to have an advantage over other teams in terms of vaccinations. And what Martinez says is pretty troubling to me. That's a personal decision. That's to each his own. Everyone has the right to believe and to think what they want to think about
this
their body.
JD
and what
now.
Their. Yes,
yeah.
I said that. It was JD. Yeah. Everyone has a right to think about their body and what they're putting into their body. So I thought, well, you know, if that attitude is prevalent at all in a group of people, then you see why people aren't getting vaccinated, because it's really not, you know, it's not to each his own kind of thing.
That's my point why I've come around on, at the very least, private businesses and private entities mandating that you need to be vaccinated to return to the workplace. Because the reality is that the Yankees didn't miss a step. They didn't miss a beat by having eight. If they would have normally had it, they would have not had that vaccination threshold of 85% of their players and staff. They would not have been able to play games.
Yep.
So you'd be scrambling. You'd be adding double headers. You'd be bringing, I don't even know if you know, you could possibly bring guys up, but if they're not vaccinated, maybe you couldn't even bring guys up from AAA. You'd be having, it would throw your schedule into disarray. So if you're choosing to not get vaccinated on your baseball team and other people are, that means that if the Red Sox have an outbreak on their team, they have to shut down operations.
Right.
That affects everybody, right? And so you're not, to me, it's not just an individual choice in that matter. It then becomes a choice about what you're willing to do or not willing to do for your teammates.
Well, it's not, by the way, it's not just the negative, which you mentioned, which is totally legit. It's also the absence of the positive, the perks that come with 85% of the eligible people being vaccinated don't exist unless you reach 85%.
Yep. Yeah, so bringing your families on the road.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah,
so
I'll tell you,
masks.
Even though these teams love saying what solidarity there is, we all love each other. Tell me that the vaccinated players on the Red Sox don't resent some of their unvaccinated teammates who, as you say, Marjorie, are precluding them from taking their families on the road.
The big thing is, and we've had all these calls from mothers yesterday, the big thing is a lot of mothers are freaked out about their young children
mm-hmm.
who cannot get vaccinated yet. They're under 12 years old. The 12 to 15-year-olds have started. We know that. But there are an awful lot of kids who are young. And even though you're less likely to get seriously ill, some children do mm-hmm. get seriously ill. So I get why these parents... You know, if my kids were under 12, I'd be a nervous wreck about all these unvaccinated people running around.
So we're talking.
I think too, if your children under 12 at this point too, aren't you just, you know, I think part of it is the frustration is you can't, if you as a parent, your two parents are fully vaccinated,
right.
Your family's all fully vaccinated, but your kid isn't.
Like exactly.
You're not limited in what you feel like you can and cannot do. So while the rest of us are running around having like, you know, a roaring 20s summer, you're kind of stuck. You're stuck. And it's been, I'm not a parent, but for my friends who are parents of younger children, this has been a trying year.
Oh my God.
You know, not being able to take your kids places and go places has been just a disaster. And now these poor baseball wives can't leave the house still because they're, you know, some of their husbands won't get vaccinated.
Just leave the kid at home. So can we change gears? Cause I don't want to give short shrift to the story that I hadn't even heard about.
NFL?
You brought it to our attention. We've talked a ton about concussions in football through the years, in great part because of the great work that's being done out of the People Concussion Legacy Foundation and Chris Nowinski and his doctor colleagues, Dr. Cantu, Dr. McKee, all these fabulous people. When I read the story that you brought to us, our attention, that in this whole litigation thing, this alleged, you know, $1 billion settlement or whatever, A couple of retired black NFL players are trying to opt out of the settlement because I almost can't believe this. The algorithm that is being used to see if there's damage done to the brains of players assumes that black players, listen to this carefully, everybody, start with lower cognitive scores. In other words, they're not as smart as the white people, so the negative impact on them has to be more extreme.
Yeah, the score has to be lower.
They start at a lower level. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And honestly, I don't even remember where I saw it, because this isn't a story that got much play. Like, it just happened to sneak into somewhere my social media feed. I think I might have, I honestly, I don't remember when I saw it, but I was shocked when I saw the headline and the posting of it. And I actually brought it up because we brought up the article because I didn't want to misspeak about it. But it's unbelievable to me that this is exactly what it says. Under the settlement, however, the NFL has insisted on using a scoring algorithm on the dementia testing that assumes black men start with lower cognitive skills. They must therefore score much lower than white players to show enough mental decline to win the award. And how this has somehow slipped through the cracks is really astonishing to me. This practice went unnoticed until 2018. And right now, a civil rights lawsuit has actually been thrown out by a judge, saying the practice is discriminatory, but that there's now a later filing and a second filing trying to get the NFL to pay everyone fairly. But I just can't believe that in this day and age that this is still happening. And somehow, I think what's most surprising to me, guys, is that I don't know, after seeing this AP story reposted sometime over the weekend or late last week, I'm not sure I've seen it anywhere gain any traction anywhere else.
Well,
and of course, the league has declined to comment on it.
Yeah, well, I don't know that we would look to the NFL for any sort of paragon of Black Lives Matter, do we? I mean, really?
Theoretically, they've had, you know, you listen to the commissioner, they've had an epiphany.
They have?
But I would argue this sort of undercuts the epiphany moment that they're bragging about, don't you think? Not to mention the fact that Colin Kaepernick is still looking for a job when Tim Tebow, who's like 80 years old and couldn't play pro football when he tried playing pro football, he may have a job with Jacksonville.
It all feels very performative, right? Like, we put the signs in the end zone and we put up the commercials during the draft. And I will say, you know, individual NFL teams have been better about hiring women and minorities into positions of actual decision making and power. But the other thing that stuck out to me, guys, in this article, and I wanted to make sure that I had the events correctly, in other major settlements, including those tied to the September 11th terrorist attacks and the Boston Marathon bombing, where people were awarded money for the explosions and everything having a cognitive effect on them, every single person, regardless of race or gender, was given an equal settlement. Mm-hmm. So there is precedent in other, in other instances where people have suffered similar disabilities due to whatever happened on the job or because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. There has not been the discrimination that has taken place in the NFL, which is once again trying to undermine a large part of their workforce.
Well, you guys know a lot more about the NFL than I do, but it always seemed to me interesting that there are so few black quarterbacks. And I've often wondered, what's that about?
Well, there are a lot more black quarterbacks now.
There
right?
are, I mean, but they're certainly not a majority of black quarterbacks.
No. How about coaches? I think that's a better
example. And the arrival
example.
Of black quarterbacks is fairly new. And people always talk about Tom Brady's brilliant ability to read the defenses and read the offenses and read what's going on. And I suspect there's a little questioning of the brains, frankly. Isn't that what part of this is about?
Marjorie, that is a perfect tie. Because even if you look at the way, like, let's just use this recent draft as an example. When you look at some of the top quarterbacks that were drafted, Trevor Lawrence and Trey Lance are black, as is Justin Fields. Ryan Wilson, Mac Jones are white. What we have heard time and again about Ryan Wilson and Mac Jones is their intelligence, their ability to read defenses, their ability to quickly process we've heard Mac Jones called a football genius in the way that he can read the field. Yet his athletic ability has been called into question, his arm strength, his mobility. But when you hear anyone talk about Justin Fields or Trey Lance or Trevor Lawrence, it's how athletic they are, how dynamic they are, how strong they are. These words we use to describe different people just become part of our lexicon and we sort of accept them. And I will say, as we've been talking leading up to the draft about all of these different guys, you know, to his credit, Tommy Curran and Phil Perry, who are our two main football guys, have really reminded us over and over and over again, guys, let's be careful how we're talking about all of these different players. Let's be mindful of the adjectives we are using. Like there was a time where there was some criticism about Justin Fields, about his Justin Fields about his character. And then I'm blanking on the second round pick that they took this year, the defensive tackle that they took from Alabama.
Jim, you must know that.
Again, they were calling into question his mental ability, his character and all these things. And Tommy Curran was like, hey, guys, let's be careful. Like, let's not use these terms because that's really charged. Right. Yeah. And we don't know. Like, there's no way to measure that. We haven't seen this person. Let's find a better way to talk about this person. I have to give our guys credit. They have been really thoughtful about how we talk about players, black or white, because we automatically put them into these containers. Right.
By the way, I don't think Lawrence is black, by the way. Is
he's,
he black?
He's white. Included? Isn't he Trevor
Lawrence?
He's white.
Is he? He's a white
guy. He's got that long blonde hair.
That's right.
The other two are African
American. Sorry. Justin Fields and Trey Lance are.
So the good news is we don't have time to ask you about whether the Olympics are going to be canceled again. We'll wait till next week. Bye.
Jim, they're not going to be canceled. We're 66 days out.
We'll see.
Trenick's going to be in Japan. Trenick Kuznarek joins every week. She's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and BPR contributor. Thanks a lot, Trenick Kuznarek. Coming up, what has the pandemic uncovered about our flawed healthcare system? That is the subject of a new Frontline and NPR documentary. We're going to talk about it up next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, over the winter, a pilot program in Chelsea started to give residents a guaranteed income of up to $400 a month. Overwhelmingly, people spent the money on food at grocery stores, convenience stores, and restaurants. Jill Shaw, the Shaw Family Foundation, which helped fund the initiative, she'll join us to discuss the program's profound impact for Chelsea residents and how the program can be a model for elsewhere.
For many Americans, this pandemic year has meant months of isolation, worries over job security, an all-encompassing sense of dread and widespread grief. While we may be resilient, the pandemic still takes its toll. Dr. Ken Duckworth, Medical Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, will join us to discuss the psychological impact of COVID-19, all that and more ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Howdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Logan, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So in the U.S., we have a healthcare system that's deeply flawed, from cost to access to who gets quality care and who gets the kind of care they really need. The only thing the pandemic has changed, it's exposed these flaws big time. Now the challenge is to figure out why disparities in healthcare persist and how to fix them. That's what the latest Frontline and NPR documentary does. It's titled The Healthcare Divide. It's made along with American University's Investigative Reporting Workshop. You can catch it tonight. For screening times, check your local PBS station for listings. You can also watch it online at pbs.org/frontline. Joining us to talk about it is NPR correspondent Laura Sullivan. Laura, it's great to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us, Laura. So let's start out with the examples of one of the examples, anyway, this terrible divide, these so-called safety net hospitals. I think in Boston, we think of Boston Medical Center down on the South End, Roxbury border, as being a safety net hospital that have really suffered. Tell us what these hospitals are and why they're in such a mess.
So safety net hospitals are the hospitals in this country that take all the patients that other hospitals don't want. These are the patients that don't have private insurance, that depend on Medicaid, that can't pay for their services at all. There are more than 300 of them across the country. Some of them are giant urban hospitals inside big urban counties, and then some of them are smaller and more rural, but they are spread out across the country. And their existence has really allowed other hospitals to do well because the safety nets are where the patients go when they can't afford care.
Yeah.
So everybody who walks into an emergency room in this country with a problem will get treated for that emergency. That's the rule. That's the law. But after that, if you have something that goes past the emergency or something that is an illness or you have a heart disease or you have cancer, all of that is going to be shifted at some point to the safety net. The for-profit and nonprofit institutions are not required to care for people with those issues.
How are these safety net hospitals, Laura, doing pre-COVID, and how did COVID affect their bottom lines and their ability to fulfill their missions?
So these hospitals have been in a lot of trouble for years. They are not paid at the same rate that private insurance pays. So anytime someone walks in the door, they're already in the hole. This has been going on for several decades now. At the same time, COVID comes around, and COVID is disproportionately affecting people who are poor, people who are the working poor, people who are in disadvantaged communities, people of color. The community that safety nets largely take care of. So they got hit harder. And what our investigation found is that the safety nets this year were taking on more of the burden, but they were not necessarily getting more of the money. In fact, when the federal government was sending out money, they first started sending out money based on how much revenue a hospital was losing. And hospitals that sent a lot of federal money to hospitals that had a lot of revenue. That's wealthy hospitals. So there was a lot of consternation about that. The federal government tried to step in and address that later on. But at the same time, we saw some of the for-profit institutions and even nonprofit institutions coming out of this year with hundreds of millions of dollars in profit or revenue. HCA, the largest for-profit institution in the country, made $3.8 billion last year, more than it made in 2019 in the middle of a pandemic. Not the safety nets. They struggled through this year. They limped through it. They were not, many of them told us they would never have survived if it hadn't been for the federal money. They would have shut their doors.
We're talking to Laura Sullivan. The documentary she's focusing in is called The Healthcare Divide. I want to ask you about this hospital you focused in on, this Erlanger, is that, I think it's...
Yes, Erlanger in Tennessee.
Yeah, in Tennessee. So they have been a safety net place for a long time. They tried to get themselves out of the hole, then they got back in the hole with COVID. So explain what happened there.
So Erlanger did what I think a lot of people would think and say, well, look, if these for-profit institutions are making so much money in our own neighborhoods, I mean, their competitors were just down the road in Chattanooga. And so they said, well, let's just do what they're doing. We're going to beef it all up. We're going to become this cutting edge facility. We're going to have helicopters and we're going to do all this. You know, we're going to lure in these great, incredible doctors. And it worked in the sense that they did start getting a lot of paying customers. A lot of customers with private insurance started coming in and their revenues started going up. The problem was they still, by mission, have to take the poor patients who don't have insurance or are on Medicaid, and they could not close that gap. It was sort of a lesson for them in the reality of American healthcare. If you have to care for people who can't pay for their care, you cannot make it work financially, no matter how many wealthy customers are sort of coming in the other side. So Erlanger made a big effort to do that, but it didn't work. So they came into the COVID with a bit of a financial heartache. This past year has dealt them another blow. Like most safety net hospitals, you know, PPE was very hard to get a hold of. Staffing with nurses were very hard to get a hold of, in the sense that it costs 10 times as much to buy a mask. And the for-profit institutions had those kind of resources. They had lines of credit. They had all kinds of great financial acumen at their disposal. And the safety nets could not afford to spend three times as much on a nurse or a medical staff person. So they were really taking it on the chin. You know, the head of the, you know, LA County USC Medical Center said, look, our expenses went way up and our revenues went way down. And unlike for, you know, these sort of wealthy hospitals, it was very difficult for them to figure out a way to make that work.
You know, was it Erlanger, Laura, where that, I think her name was Teresa Atkins, made that incredibly beautiful comment about something like, I like to be somebody no matter where I go. And I think her point was she was treated like somebody, like every other human being deserves to be treated at this safety net hospital in her hometown. It was Erlanger, right?
Yeah, that was at Erlanger.
It was beautiful. Yes. You know, before we get to the sort of other way safety net hospitals try to stay afloat, namely the private equity direction, and we only have to drive down the road, I guess, about an hour from here to Rhode Island to talk about that example from your film. What is the federal... I mean, Marjorie and I talk a lot about how scandalous it is that there's so many governors, I think a dozen or so, who have turned down Medicaid money, which obviously would help the poorest people in their community, because of their ideologically sick and deranged opposition to, you know, federal money actually helping their constituents. But for the same members of Congress, what is their reaction to the obvious that you can't continue to fund a service at less than its cost and have the recipient of the funding ever stay afloat? I mean, what do they think is going to happen here?
I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting. I asked the same question. I was trying to figure out why would 12 states not want to expand Medicaid in their states? And I came from the same kind of perspective too, where I said, look, it sounds like you guys are just leaving money on the table. Why wouldn't you take the free money? What are you thinking? But, you know, some analysts and some politicians in these states explained to me that they had to still pay too much, that they were talking about some of the poorest states, and that even though they were getting, you know, let's say they were getting 60% from the federal government, they still had to come up with their 40, and it was just too much to sell to their voters. Some of it got swept up in politics, as healthcare always has been for the past 30 years in this country. And it did. That is true. But it was also that it wasn't that the money on the table had some strings attached, and they couldn't get around the strings, and they couldn't sell it to their voters because the strings were expensive.
But based upon that response, then they shouldn't take any Medicaid money, because they're always going to be
in
a shortfall. Medicare reimburses at a higher rate. So if the reimbursement rate is too low, if you take expansion of Medicaid money, it's still too low for your...
I think they're struggling to cover the amount of Medicaid that they're already covering. To them, an expansion of Medicaid just meant that they were going to have to come up with more out of pocket in their own state, and they couldn't figure out a way to make that work and make it palatable to voters. Some of them are coming around, though, because at this point, the thing that we sort of learned in this story is that taxpayers pay for this regardless. We're paying for the healthcare people who don't have insurance, or the gap between what Medicaid and Medicare pay compared to what private insurance pay. we're all paying for that anyway. There's this idea that someone walks into emergency room, racks up a $100,000 bill, they can't pay it. Somebody comes in and pays that. That is not true. Taxpayers pay that every single time, whether it be the local county taxpayers, the state taxpayers, or the federal taxpayers. So it's all coming back to taxpayers anyway. If Medicaid, if, you know, federal taxpayers, if all of us wanted to spend more on Medicaid, we could close a lot of these gaps. We could make poor patients sought after if that's where the public wanted to spend its money. We could eliminate this growing divide between the patients who have no health care and the patients who do, and the hospitals that treat the patients with no health care and the for-profit institutions that treat the patients with the money. We can close this growing divide, but you'd have to cover 30 million Americans without insurance, and you'd have to pay more for Medicaid. Those are expensive things for taxpayers. And I think, as we've seen for 30 years, not easy to do in this country. You know, Clinton tried to take this on, lost control of Congress. Obama created the Affordable Care Act, lost control of Congress. Trump tried to go in and tinker with the Affordable Care Act, lost control of Congress. It is very difficult politically to take on healthcare in the United States.
We're talking with Laura Sullivan. The new Frontline documentary is called The Healthcare Divide. You can catch it tonight. You just said a few minutes ago that some of these for-profit hospitals, or I think you said even nonprofit hospitals, made lots of money during the pandemic.
Yeah.
How they make all that money?
So if you're a for-profit or a nonprofit hospital with lots of revenue, the patients that are generally walking your door, and you may do some charity, you may do some charity care, and that is great. But the money, every patient that comes in your door that has private insurance is money for you. That is, I mean, the more customers, the more profit. It is your it is like operating like a regular old business. If you're a safety net hospital, the more patients that come in your door, the more in the hole you are, because Medicaid is paying 70 cents on the dollar, right, for the actual service that you're that you're getting. So every patient, it's like every patient that walks in the door has a dollar sign on their head. Okay. If we do this procedure on this patient, we're going to get $5. If we do this procedure on this patient, we're going to be down 50, you know, we owe somebody 50 cents.
Right.
So it's just very divergent. So if you're in a, you know, a wealthier community, I mean, a lot of people told us in this story that geography is destiny. If you're in a wealthy community or, you know, a strong working community where people have insurance, you know, everybody that comes in your door, you're going to do really well. So even if those people have COVID, so if people come in your door with COVID and they have private insurance, you make money. If they don't have private insurance and they come in their door and they have COVID and they're coming from communities that were disproportionately affected by COVID, and that is the communities that Safety Net serve, those are folks that are going to have more difficult problems, longstanding problems, and every day they're in the hospital costs money.
We're talking to Laura Sullivan. The film is called The Healthcare Divide. It actually should be called We Are Screwed, let me tell you. But if we can go from Tennessee to Rhode Island, if the feds don't come to the rescue, some people think, or thought at least, private equity firms will come to the rescue. Well, one did at, what is it called, Fatima and Roger Williams. What happened there? Tell us that story, Laura Sullivan.
So that has not worked out, according to a number of the unions there, and some of the community members do not feel that has worked out for them at all up there. Private equity has bought a number of safety net hospitals because they're vulnerable, and they feel like they can turn them into for-profit moneymakers, right? And in some cases, they say, you know, look, we're doing the community a favor because this hospital would have closed if we hadn't stepped in to save it. And a lot of people up at those hospitals told us that that's what they felt when they came in, like the knight in shining armor is coming to save us, and they're going to figure out a way to do the finances better, and we're going to go back to helping people. And instead, you saw them incredibly disappointed and frustrated and angry, where they felt like the care that they were able to give the patients had gone down. They didn't have the supplies they needed. And a lot of the nursing unions and staff unions felt that they were misled by what was going to happen. This all culminated in the company taking on debt in order to pay its investors.
This is grotesque. Can I interrupt you? We have sound from the guy who was that you interviewed, who's the general counsel of the United Nurses and Allied Professionals, commenting on the fact that they paid out in the middle of this thing. They borrow $1 billion, as you're about to suggest, and pay out almost $500 million in dividends to their investors. I just can't even believe this is legal. Here is here's this general counsel of the union.
Well, so what I thought was this is boundless greed. They go to struggling communities that need these safety net hospitals to provide care, and that they're going in there and they're taking advantage of these communities and these people to buy these assets, borrow against the assets, to then free up capital to make these grotesque dividend payments.
So what's their response to these, it's not charges, to these facts, Laura Sullivan?
Yeah, the company says that it has paid that money back, that yes, it makes a profit, that's what it does, and that they're not, you know, that is a good thing for an American company, and that this did not in any way affect the care of the patients, and that they were able to pay these dividends because they've been so successful at what they've done at these hospitals. That is not the impression that the nursing and medical staff unions, they do not agree with that.
So Laura Sullivan, if Medicaid did reimburse what they should, 100%, what would that mean for safety net hospitals?
So if we were able to close, look at it this way, like 15 years ago, private insurance was paying $1.50 for every dollar that Medicaid was paying for the same service.
Yeah.
In 2018, now it's $2.50 Medicare is paying for the same service private insurance is paying $2.50 for the same service that Medicare is paying. So this is getting worse and worse every year that goes on. So Medicare and Medicaid need to either come up to the private insurance's $2.50. Or private insurance needs to come down, and somehow they need to meet in the middle. Some people feel that the $2.50 is way too high, and that this is encouraging people to have unnecessary procedures and things like that. There's criticism on that end too. Without that happening, what the analysts and sort of experts all told us is that this divide, this gap, is unsustainable. That we're going to create two levels of care in this country, the care for the poor and the care for everybody else. And everybody else is going to get really good care at great places with cutting edge technology. And the poor are going to end up getting barely anything, and that nobody's going to want to care for the poor. It's just this is just not a group that a lot of people advocate for. You have to think about this group as, these are the working poor. These are folks that sometimes have mental health issues. These are older Americans. When we were in L.A. County, USC Medical Center, just that week, there was just a lot of people that were, it was an unidentified person with dementia, a woman who had walked out of a skilled nursing facility and was found on the street 2 days later. I mean, it was just very complicated, difficult problems. Safety nets also need to place people in most communities. They can't just open their door and send them back out. So at LA County USC, the head of the system there was telling us that he said that he had had patients there for 3 years. He had, not because they were still sick and couldn't go somewhere else, to get the rest of their care or go home, is that they had no home, no other place would take them. And so they had to stay in the hospital for 3 years. That is federal taxpayers paying for that.
Also, you add to your list of who's harmed here is you have interviewed somebody near the end of the film. It says this Medicaid reimbursement system is systemic racism because so many of the people who make use, like at Boston Medical Center, of these safety net hospitals are people of color who get screwed sort of coming and going. The last thing I want to say to you, for people listening and say this is horrible, but at the end of the day, as horrible as it is, government will come to the rescue. My uncle was a doctor who practiced part-time at Hahnemann Hospital in my hometown of Philadelphia, a safety net hospital. It's closed. And it's conceivable that we end up, if these private equity robbers aren't the solution, and if the federal government continues to underfund, we could see more of these closing, which means even more inadequate care for poor people who often suffer from the most health needs than we even see now, Laura Sullivan.
Yes, and the head of the Safety Net Association, America's Essential Hospitals, said that it's one thing to sort of talk about, well, okay, so these safety nets are going to close and, you know, people don't want to fund them anymore. But these are people, you know, these are people's lives. I mean, at what point do you say you can't even wrap your brain. We're like, we're just going to let people die. Like, what are we doing? You know, you keep wondering, like you're saying, like, there's got to be a line, right, where this stops. But so far we haven't found it.
Well, I'll tell you, you really paint the picture beautifully and painfully, and we really appreciate it, and everybody should watch tonight. Laura, it's great to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laura Sullivan is a correspondent for NPR. You can catch her tonight in the documentary The Healthcare Divide. It's an NPR and Frontline collaboration made along with American University's Investigative Reporting Workshop. For screening times, check your local PBS listings. You can also watch it online at pbs.org/frontline. Thanks again to Laura Sullivan.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When Andrew Yang was running for president, his ideas on universal basic income earned him a lot of fans, if not a lot of votes. Yang also got a lot of laughs from his fellow candidates, who treated his freedom dividend, that was $1,000 for every American with no strings attached a month, as a gimmick rather than a gateway to financial stability. Today, Yang's ideas are taking root in cities across the country. Stockton, California was the first one to launch a guaranteed income experiment. Critics said it would lead to unemployment and poor spending choices. Data proved them wrong. When the pilot program wrapped up, an independent study recently found that full-time employment rose among those who received the guaranteed income and that their financial, physical, and emotional health improved. Last November, Chelsea became the country's biggest guaranteed income experiment, giving out no-strings-attached checks to 2,000 low-income families. Well, now preliminary data from the experiment is in. Here to share it with us is Jill Shaw. Jill is the president of the Shaw Family Foundation, which has been a major investor and supporter of the initiative. Jill, it's great to talk to you again.
Hi, Jim. It's great to talk with you as well.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for joining us, Jill. So before we get to the data, what you've learned from Chelsea, give us some history, Jill. Tell us how this all came to be.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We got engaged with Chelsea as we were doing work with the state on food access as COVID started. And Chelsea, as we all know, was one of the hardest hit places in America. And pretty quickly, there were food lines wrapped around, you know, the neighborhood with people dramatically out of work, huge amounts of huge rates of COVID-19 in the city. And so we went there first to help Tom Ambrosino, the head of Chelsea, think about how to get food to people. And he literally stood up a food pantry that brought in 45,000 pounds of food a day, broke it down in a park, and then handed it out to folks for hours. And by the time August came around, it just wasn't tenable to continue doing that. And so he started thinking about, you know, what is a more efficient way to help people access what they need. And that turned into us having a deep conversation about a guaranteed income program. But, you know, it was really all driven out of a dramatic need to help folks, you know, be as well as they could be as this pandemic was raging. And so he set it up. It's a very simple. There was a lottery. There were over 3,000 folks who applied, deeply vulnerable folks in the city. And about 2,000 of them are receiving on average $400 a week and have been for many months now. And so we just got our first set of data back, which is spending data, which is really interesting.
Well, that's what we want to hear about. What's the spending data? I guess it's some organization at Harvard that's monitoring this thing and reporting. What does it tell you so far?
That's right, Jim. So Jeff Liebman out of Harvard Kennedy School has been leading the research. And it's interesting. The data really speaks for itself on this. So as they did this part of the study, there was already $2.1 million out in Chelsea to recipients. Almost 75% of that was spent at food retailers, and the rest was spent primarily on clothing, household goods, utilities, and transportation. Almost every dollar was spent locally, and a ton of it was spent at the local market basket and local, you know, small restaurants. So it was also helping spur on the local economy, which, you know, was kind of a two for one.
So what does that say, that 75% went to food, clothing, transportation, household goods, about people's choices?
I'll tell you what it says. When Ronald Reagan was president and he was saying we can't give welfare to poor people because they're going to spend every dollar at liquor stores and buying lottery tickets,
right,
or whatever.
They're going to buy Mercedes-Benz.
He was wrong, and the critics of this kind of thing were also wrong. Is that a fair answer on your behalf, Jill Shaw?
I think it's exactly right, Jim. So less than 1% was spent at liquor stores or smoke shops. And I think that's right on, right? Like all people spend money the same way. And we spend it first to meet our basic human needs, you know, food, shelter, and safety. And that's how this money was spent, which is no different than how any of us would spend money.
Well, you know what else was interesting? And you could explain this for us, Jill Shaw, is how is it that full-time employment rose? How would that
be? Stockton you're talking about, right?
Well, I think that's not just Stockton. I think that was in other places that this has gone on. Maybe not in Chelsea, but in other places this has gone on.
Well, so we'll have that data out in July. But you're right, Marjorie, that many different programs that have been run around guaranteed income have all shown the same thing, that people tend to continue to work, look for better jobs, right? Because they feel like they have a bit of a buffer. And so they actually can take a breath, and they tend to find better work during these programs.
And we presume that you mentioned there was a lottery, but we presume that the people that apply for this lottery were not high rollers. They were people in economic duress.
Yeah. So the way that these folks were recruited was off of the food line. So if you were standing in a food line in Chelsea, we were talking to you, the city was talking to you about the guaranteed income program, which was, we called it Chelsea Eats. It was about making sure that you had food through the pandemic. And we let people know that, you know, this food distribution system was going to go away for the winter and that this was going to replace it. And so, yes, these folks were all living at or below poverty.
So, Jill Shaw, why did the city manager in Chelsea and you and the other movers here conclude that direct payments in advance, obviously prior to the experiment itself, for lack of a better expression, was a preferable route to keep people as healthy and as well-fed as possible than food pantries, for example?
I think all of us really trust humans. And we trusted that we knew this would be much more efficient, right? And it would be much safer. Those food lines weren't terribly safe with people standing outside close to each other for many hours. And so we wanted safety. We wanted efficiency. We wanted as much of the support to go directly to individuals and not to all of the infrastructure that we needed to hand out food the way it was being handed out. And we trusted people. And so, you know, that group of things, and Tom Ambrosino also talked about the dignity of this program, right? This is a much more dignified way to support our fellow neighbors.
So if we should go back to the beginning again and talk about where the money came from, because I'm assuming that your goal is not just to help people in Chelsea, but to use Chelsea as a model and to replicate this in cities and towns where there's need, which is everywhere across Massachusetts and beyond. Well, if I recall correctly, it was like $1.5 million or something from Chelsea. Your foundation gave $1 million. There's a lot of private money here, right?
There's a lot of private money here. That's right. The United Way helped raise funding for it. MGH participated. Beth Israel participated. So, and a number of independent individual donors did as well. There was also Tom used CARES Act money, as well as some city funding to support the program. And we wanted to do it, as we always do at the Shaw Family Foundation, as a public-private partnership to just help government think about ways to deploy capital. And we're super bullish on this. The data so far that we're seeing and we're hearing a lot about what the surveyors are hearing out in the field, you can trust people to give them cash. It will be much more efficient and effective. And we should be thinking about doing that very strategically with our most vulnerable population here in the state, as well as across the country. You know, Jim and Marjorie, I think we're going to come to a point very quickly where there are more jobs than people to fill them. But a lot of those jobs will still not have the salary base that will help people, you know, thrive. And so I think a combination of guaranteed income and access to jobs is the way to really help, you know, solve for poverty in America.
Well, you know, despite your commitment to these public-private partnerships, I assume you agree if this is replicated on a grand scale around this country, that the primary players have to be state, local, and federal governments, right? I mean, they got to pick up a huge percentage of the cost. That's correct, yes?
Well, totally agree with that. I think where philanthropy can play a great role is in instigating things like this, continuing pilots, and studying them.
So what's the evidence so far? And I hope you have some. I mean, we talked to the mayor of Cambridge a couple of weeks ago about the thing that's starting here, I think, in August. I believe it's in August. Is there evidence either on the state level or in Congress that people are paying attention to what you're doing? I know this first set of data is just a couple of weeks old. But is there interest?
Yes.
Give us some examples of what you've encountered.
So at every level, we're getting inquiries, you know, local, state, and federal, about how this program is working, what the data says about this program, what our point of view is on how it should be deployed or expanded. There's lots of people who are very interested in this, and I think it's all early stage. There's also great, efforts down in Washington to really think through how do we support and, you know, structure supports for our most vulnerable populations. And I think this is all in the mix, and we'll just keep feeding the data in as it comes to us.
We're talking to Jill Shaw. She's president of the Shaw Family Foundation. You know, in one of these stories, I think it was a Globe magazine piece talking about this guaranteed minimum income, it pointed out that some people have estimated it would cost about $1 billion to do this in Massachusetts, but they add that is less than what the state gives to corporations every year in special tax breaks. So juxtaposing those sorts of figures makes it seem perhaps more affordable than you might initially think.
Well, and also I think about there's lots of money that's targeted at supporting our most vulnerable neighbors already. There's just a lot of infrastructure around it as well. And so, you know, part of what we think about here, it's the same thing that we did with school food in a way. We showed that there was a much more streamlined way to spend that money and feed kids better and create more jobs.
By the way, explain that, because many people may not know what you're doing with the food in the schools, Jill Shaw.
Oh, sure. Thank you. So in collaboration with the city of Boston and Boston Public Schools, this is our final summer. Every kitchen, every school in the city of Boston will have a My Way Cafe kitchen.
Wow.
And those will all be turned on. There will be, you know, there's three times as many jobs created, and all kids will have whole, real, culturally relevant, delicious, eat a rainbow meals every day for breakfast and lunch.
By the way, stay on this just for 1 second, because the film that you guys did about this project, the thing that stays with me is, well, kids ultimately were, I mean, there were a couple things that stay with me, I guess three. One, that kids were ultimately loving the healthy food. That was one. Okay. Two, was it Ken Oranger who was teaching
great
the lunch
chef
ladies how to do tofu, which I thought was one of the best scenes in a movie in years. And the third thing was there was the kid throwing his lunch or her lunch in the garbage prior to your coming, because who wants to eat that crap? I mean, I remember it. Marjorie remembers. I'm sure you do too, Jill. And
totally.
And what do we learn? What percentage of a kid's daily nutrition in a public school comes from what they eat at a school? It's some huge percentage, right?
I mean, it's at least two meals a day, maybe three meals a day.
Yeah. So,
mentioned that program saved money.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, because it's funny. Ken taught us this. So Ken and I were both staring at this like prepackaged roast beef. And I was like, what do we do with it? He's like, you just don't do that. You buy real meat and you cook it. It's way cheaper. I said, how could it be real cheaper? He said, because you don't pay for the plastic, you don't pay for the preservatives, you don't pay for the profit. And so, like, we just learned so much through this. But real food costs less than prepackaged crappy food.
You know, the other thing it seems to me that's really valuable about what you did in Chelsea, beyond the fact that the preliminary reports back are all good ones, that the goals are being achieved, is unlike Stockton was a pretty small experiment, and people, it was like 125 people or some such thing out of a city of, I think, hundreds of thousands. You had a huge percentage of the families in Chelsea. What was it, 12 or 15% on this program? I mean, that's a huge chunk of people living there. So it's a pretty good cross section. And it seems to me, and that the point you made in response to Marjorie a minute ago is it's not just as compared to what we spend on, you know, for example, corporate tax breaks. Who wants to have that fight? It's deciding how better to spend the money we're already spending, trying to have people not as fortunate as we are live better lives. And it seems to me that the critical ingredient is, our elected leaders going to trust poor people like they trust their middle class constituents to do responsible things? I mean, that's really what this comes down to, because the evidence is mounting that this is, as you say, the best and most efficient way to help poor people lead better, more productive lives. No?
I agree with you. Trust is such a big deal. It's such a big deal that we're actually working on a study right now that's national that looks at why we have the points of view that we do about poor people, including how poor people look at other poor people, because there's something in that that has killed guaranteed income programs throughout history. It killed them over in England when they were tried. They use that same false data here when Nixon pushed it all the way through the House, almost had the Senate to agree with it. And then it got killed at the last minute using data that wasn't true. And so it's just, there's something about the way that we think about poor people that makes us resistant to trusting them. And we're trying to figure out what that is, because the opposite thing appears to be true every time you run guaranteed income programs. Folks thrive. They use it to deal with food, shelter, and safety. They make their lives better. And we all benefit from that, right? This is not a zero-sum game. So this is all net positive opportunity for this country. And I think, there's been lots of times in America where this has been important. This is really important right now.
Well, there are two things that I wonder about, Jill Shaw, is the need for a lot of these people is attached to the fact that the living wage, there's not a living wage that they can earn.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the housing and the cost of everything. That's part of it. Their income is so low, even if they are working full time. Right.
That's we're in a global economy, right? So we're competing, against pressures from other countries. So wages are definitely at play here, as well as our macroeconomics.
And the other thing is, you mentioned before that it's the infrastructure that we have in place ends up being much more expensive than just giving direct payments. So elaborate on that a minute. What do you mean by that?
Well, so think about doing something like our SNAP program, which is what we call food stamps. So that takes tons of people in Washington and here at the state. There's lots of lawyers and advocates and community partners who all are working at just getting people signed up for SNAP. Then there are the folks who negotiate with the product companies so that product companies can get their products included on the SNAP formulary, because you don't walk in with a SNAP card. You can't buy certain things in the grocery store, right? And I think WIC for women and children is even more restrictive. And so all of that stuff takes work. You've got to track it all. On SNAP, people have to play this game of, I don't want to make too much money because then I don't qualify for SNAP, right? And so you're like always living on the edge, as opposed to give folks cash and let them get a job and give them enough space to breathe, fulfill food, shelter, and safety, and they'll also prosper.
You know, I'm wondering too, if you thought about the connection between this child care tax credit, that I think the payment's going to start going out in July, that will give people a guaranteed income, you know, a certain amount of money for kids under six, certain amount of money for kids over six and stuff, because that's basically giving money directly to people too. That ties in to this, doesn't it?
Sure does. That is a form of guaranteed income, if you think about it, for families across America. And it, everyone qualifies, you know, vulnerable folks qualify for that. And actually another initiative at the foundation is helping make sure that people submit their taxes so that they can qualify for that. Because I don't think you have to earn any money, actually. You don't have to have an income to benefit from the earned income tax credit.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, it's done as a monthly benefit. So we think there'll be impact locally because people who get monthly checks as opposed to one lump sum tend to spend them and they tend to spend them locally. And so that will should prove out. And it's massive in terms of the amount of money that will go out into the country that way. And so we should see some really significant things happen from that.
Yeah.
The thing is, it's for families and children. And so the, you know, it's kind of like we need to think of ways to extend that, right? We do have undocumented folks in this country who, if we don't help take care of them, they end up, you know, just we're paying too much in terms of healthcare and other supports. And so we should just be support. If you're a resident of this country, we should be supporting you and helping you thrive. And so there are, you know, folks who are single who are not covered by that tax credit. But that tax credit does go a long way in helping families and children, I think.
Yeah, I'm so glad you two brought it up because, you know, this whole, which we should have even done earlier. I mean, for those who are saying, well, it's too radical to do a guaranteed basic income. Marjorie, as you said and Jill confirmed, that's what this program is.
Right.
And as Richie Neal, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, told us about a week or so ago on the show, the goal is to make it permanent and have it not just be a one-year thing. So he's essentially right. saying Congress, he hopes, is going to buy into a permanent guaranteed basic income program, a limited fashion for a piece of the population. So,
yeah.
Jill, before you leave us, we heard your competition, which we rarely talk about, but tell us a little bit about this podcast series you've been doing.
I could never hope to be competitive with you guys.
That's the right answer.
Yeah.
Thank you very
yeah.
much. Correct.
We were fishing for that, Jill.
Go ahead.
But yeah, so we do a podcast called Catalyst for Change, and it was started because we were having such interesting conversations in our office that we thought other people might want to hear them. And so it, you know, I've interviewed people like Andrew Yang and Rachel Rollins, Maura Healey, Feng Zhang, who was one of the founders of CRISPR, Mark Hyman. Yeah, I mean, so it's a fun podcast, and Boston is in a really exciting time, right? We're going for the first time in history, Boston will have a mayor of color, and there's some incredible candidates, right, who we really should all know for the future too. One of them will be our new mayor, and the rest of them are going to go on to do incredible things. And so we have taped conversations with each one of them about being mayor of Boston. They're really fun. I do think that you get a sense of who they are. They're long form, so they're probably around 45 minutes each. And so anyone who really wants to kind of dive in these podcasts, the first one just launched today with Michelle Wu, who's amazing. And they'll be once a week coming out. And you can either go to our website, Shaw Foundation, SHAH foundation.org, or Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before you go away, if people also want to learn about the work in Chelsea and beyond, will they get information at the same site?
Yeah, they should go to shawfoundation.org. The Globe has been writing some articles about it, which has been terrific. And there'll be a bunch more out there. But if anyone wants to, we'll hold in July, we'll have the data. And we'll hold some sort of event where we'll share the data broadly. And I'm sure, you know, we'll share it with media. We'll share it with you guys. And so there's more to come on that as well.
Great. Great. Congratulations on the work so far, Jill. It's really exciting. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Jill, and congratulations, too, from here. Jill Shaw is president of the Shaw Family Foundation, which is supporting efforts between Chelsea and philanthropic partners for one of the largest universal basic income programs in the nation. She's also the host of the Catalyst for Change podcast. Jill Shaw, thanks so much for joining us again. Coming up, the COVID blues. How can we get our way out of the mental and emotional toll the pandemic has taken on us? Dr. Ken Duckworth joins me for that conversation next. and 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. The last year has been a mix of uncertainty, of isolation. For many, it's also been one of financial anxiety and loss. Even for people who are coming out of the pandemic relatively unscathed, lockdown has taken a toll. Recent polling, I'm sure you've seen it, finds that anxiety remains high. As we come out of the pandemic, more people are reporting mental health issues compared to that which they reported last year. Joining us online to talk through why this year has left a lot of us mentally and emotionally depleted is Dr. Ken Duckworth. Dr. Duckworth is the Senior Medical Director for Behavioral Health at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. He's also the National Medical Director for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Dr. Duckworth, we always enjoy talking to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me back, Jim.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, great to talk to you again. And I think, believe the last time we talked to you, we were kind of in the midst of this whole situation. Now we're starting to come out of the pandemic, at least the worst of the pandemic. So how have things changed?
Well, let me start with the silver lining, if I might.
Sure.
I think a lot of people are willing to talk about mental health and substance use disorders in ways that we didn't before, because so many of us are either experiencing it or love somebody who is. And so, again, this is the silver lining department in a very difficult year. But I feel like this whole idea that once you see something, you can never unsee it. There's a lot of shame associated with mental health. A lot of people had been in the past resistant to talking about it and getting help. And I feel like that's changed. So I'll just start with the positive there, Marjorie.
You know, I just wonder, pandemic aside just for a second, is that generational? Because I get the sense of young people are much more ready to talk about this than people that are 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, older people.
I think it's in part generational. Young yeah. people are going to lead the way on this. They also have higher incidence
yeah.
of anxiety and depression. So they're both more open and it's more part of their experience. So I salute them, and I feel like the future is bright on this dimension, people's willingness to talk about it and get help for it.
Dr. Duckworth, I don't want to chasten you, but we don't do positive on this show. So that's
oh, I'm sorry.
I'm afraid that's
enough.
Our time
is up for today,
Jim.
Exactly.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very nice.
In all seriousness, though, I'm really glad you did lead that way, by the way. But I think I was reading something from your organization, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, in terms of the number of people who, I guess, self-report as having mental health concerns. And it seems to me, if I remember correctly, the number from pre-pandemic times to hopefully on the outside of the pandemic is close to 2 to 1. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So the Center for Disease Control did this beautiful study last summer that showed that 2 in 5 Americans have clinically significant mental health symptoms. So the same kind of screens that you would take at the primary care doctor's office. What we saw at Blue Cross is that the numbers for anxiety went up a great deal. That was not a claim that was kind of the dominant number one claim before. It was number one, but, you know, depression and other phenomena were right behind it. 60% of people had a diagnosis evaluated by their mental health practitioner of anxiety disorders. And so what we've seen is that many more people are having mental health vulnerabilities. You also saw in separate data, the opiate overdose death rate is increasing.
Yeah.
More people are seeking help for anxiety disorders. So this has been a profound mental health wave.
I would assume, you know, to harken back to your positive opening here, we talked to you when we spoke last several months ago about the explosion of telehealth, not just for physical health concerns, but psychological ones too. And I know those numbers have held, if not even gotten greater. I assume that's another silver lining is people who might otherwise not have access to, and we'll discuss access in a few minutes, access to or didn't even want to go into a shrink or a psychologist or a therapist office may feel more comfortable in that circumstance. Is that true?
That's true. And the other benefit for the practitioners is that the no-show rate is virtually zero.
Really?
And so the practitioners also benefit from not commuting and from having a virtually zero no-show rate. And so you know, a few people who've given up private offices, like this is working for them. Many people prefer to see people in person. And, you know, I think that that will be a preference for a lot of people. But some people are just going to make the transition to virtual.
You know, Dr. Duckworth, we started today by talking to our listeners about the reopening of virtually every high school, public high school in the state yesterday, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. And Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, I'd say 50% of the people who called, some parents, we had a pediatrician, we had a psychologist, at least 50% without any prompting from us immediately went to the mental health strain this has put on kids. We've read a lot about it, but you're in the business. What has this been like for kids, and what's the prescription to get out of what they've suffered through?
Well, first of all, I think those of us who have even a little gray hair should freely acknowledge that the younger generation has given up so much protect more medically vulnerable people, that if you look at the medical vulnerability, it's all in the 60-plus club.
Yeah.
Look at the mental health impact. You're talking people 15 to 30 primarily. They're in the stage of life where it's crucial, and younger than 15, but really especially that age, 15 to 30. They're the people who are trying to get out, form relationships. Their developmental tasks are to find an identity, who will love them, what might they do in this world. You know, and they've been in their mom's basement in a lot of the time. And so developmentally, I'm supposed to be watching Netflix and walking a dog. I'm not missing that much, right? Developmentally. Mm-hmm. But developmentally, a high school senior has missed prom.
Yeah.
Being the star of the football team. These things aren't coming back. And they've just simply missed these developmental moments. And so it's really important to remember how much the younger generation has given up. Acknowledge that, you know, talk with them about it, and no complaints about younger generations for a long time.
But you know, one of the things I worry about is that the people, I don't know if this falls within your jurisdiction, are adults of the belief that, is to use that overused expression, that you just flip the light switch now that we're beginning, these kids are beginning to get back in the real world. The problems that they suffer through. I read this morning 51% 18 to 29 year olds have suffered from or self-identified as having some level of depression over the past year. Is there this, I assume, misconception that you just flip the switch and then the kids are back to normal? And assuming that that is incorrect, what is the path from here to mental health for these kids?
Well, I think it's really important to respect the individual nature of this. Some people are quite resilient. And in 6 months, or when they're seniors in high school and they're in college and actually having a college experience, they'll remember this and it may impact their thinking about the world. But some people who've, you know, been activated on anxiety or depression or relapse of substances will continue to struggle. And I think it's just important to respect that. I don't think people are light switches. But some people do have more resilience or strengths. But I think a lot of people, you know, will have a recurrent vulnerability going forward once this has begun. So I think it's a very individual business. So I try not to paint with too broad a brush. Just be respectful of what young people have given up. And just remember, you know, that in these developmental moments, you know, some of them aren't coming back. And so, you know, I think, you know, paying for things like, you know, college or free college or community college for, you know, no tuition. These are the kind of policies that would be respecting what this generation has to
yeah. give
to the point.
This is my opinion. And again, those are kind of policy positions, but this generation gave up the most, and we need to remember that.
You know, we're talking, by the way, Dr. Ken Duckworth, Senior Medical Director for Behavioral Health at Blue Cross Blue Shield. Got that out, Marjorie. You know, when you were talking about that, I was thinking in my own life, too. My older children live in New York City, where they were pummeled by COVID, and they would talk about the sirens, and seeing all the, you know, the waiting for the morgues to be set up in Central Parks, et cetera. Then you think about kids like in poor neighborhoods, like in Chelsea, or in inner city neighborhoods where they suffered a lot more from the pandemic, relatives getting sick, people in their homes getting sick. It seems to me those are the people, not so much, you know, New York, because if you had a job in your apartment and stuff, but it was still traumatic being in a place that was so uncertain. But being stuck in one of those situations where you're crammed together and your family's getting sick, those are the young people that seems to me really got hammered. They couldn't go to school to get out of the house, and they in their house there were sick people, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, they may have grief, they may have loss, they may have lost a parent, right? And to get back to the tele point of view, some people don't have the internet or privacy, and right. So sessions are now something that is a lifeline from an equity position, because many people have a phone or a flip phone, but not everybody has, you know, stable internet or privacy where you can talk.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
I just feel like that was a step forward. And unlike video enabled, which has been super well studied, we haven't really studied phone sessions, but it seems like the right thing to do as a lifeline.
You know what else I was surprised at, Doctor, when we were talking to people earlier, and this is just a small sample, obviously, from our radio show, but how many people emailed or called and said their kids were thrilled about being home. They didn't really want to go back to school. The kids were introverts, or they were bullied, yes. or they were in the wrong clique. So this opportunity to focus on their studies without worrying about what they were wearing every day and all that kind of stuff was a boon to them. So that kind of created this kind of dog-eat-dog picture of school.
It's complicated, isn't it? And this is the individual nature of it. I think there are some kids, you know, that experience less anxiety for all these kind of social reasons. But September will be a lift for them because they won't have had the exposure of dealing with it successfully, right?
Yeah. Many,
as it relate to anxiety, is you expose yourself to the thing that you're anxious about, whether it's flying on a plane, public speaking, or snakes, right? Many of the treatments involve exposing yourself to the thing that makes you anxious. And if school, bullying, those things make you anxious, your ability to navigate that successfully is going to be helpful. So I think in September, some of these kind of kids who are experiencing some relief during this, it will be a hard time for them.
So is the same true of kids now? We're talking a lot about violence against Asian Americans, something that we hadn't really talked about much before. We've also gotten emails from parents who say their kids don't want to go back to school because they're Asian Americans or they're from a country in Asia and they're worried about getting bullied in school. I think what you're saying is that you have to learn coping mechanisms for that kind of thing?
Well, it's coping mechanisms for the individual, but the leadership at the school has to make sure that kind of reprehensible behavior like that is just simply laid out as unacceptable. But it is also the development of coping skills and strategies to contend with that on the individual basis. So that's for the individual and, for instance, the school culture.
We're talking to Dr. Ken Duckworth. He is the National Medical Director for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and he is the Senior Medical Director for Behavioral Health at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. You know, you said several times, Doctor, that it's kids who have given up the most. I would argue a close second are people in your profession, in the healthcare field. I can't imagine having lived through a public facing job in your industry over the past 14 months and how much pain they've seen and how much they had to deal with and that sort of stuff. What is the state of affairs? How are providers doing? Are they seeking help? Are they leaving the profession? What's the after effect there?
I think, again, it's pretty individual. But if you know a nurse, take them out to dinner. At your local restaurant. Seriously, these were healthcare heroes in the most, you know, basic sense. Doctors, nurses, the social workers in the hospital. These people are God's work. Emergency room physicians. You know, if you scratch your finger and go in, thank every single person who works in the emergency room. There are some anxieties in the health professions about seeking help. And these relate a little bit to archaic laws for licensure. We don't really have this problem in Massachusetts. But I think it's really important to remember that it's okay to seek help, that your license won't be put on the line. But historically, there's been a little complexity around that, some mixed messages. There was just a paper that came out reviewing state licensure in all 50 states and how some states are doing a better job at making it easy to seek help, only asking mental health questions that are relevant to the licensure, not a broad question, have you ever had a mental health thing? It's how is your functioning now? That sort of thing. So it's a good question. I think the healthcare field has been traumatized. In large measure, and I think it's been a very difficult time for them. And I do know a few people, you know, who've made the decision to change their career, not leave the field, but change their focus. You know, working in an intensive care unit is incredibly painful and hard.
I can't imagine. You know, Dr. Duckworth, every time we've spoken to you, even pre-pandemic, we've talked about access and access issues and, you know, so many people providing, I shouldn't say so many, but well, actually it is so many, providing mental health care don't take insurance, which obviously means those of us who were upper middle class are in fine shape and those who are not in fine shape. Now that the need is growing in so many directions after this last 14 months, is access, I know it's easier because of, as you say, phone and telehealth and that sort of stuff. Is it any more available when the need is greater than it was a year ago?
Well, it took, you know, I say 8 months to make a mental health crisis and 8 years to make a social worker. So the supply is slow, right?
Yeah.
And the demand went up quickly, especially with the increase in prevalence and attitude changes. I don't know if you just saw several pharmacies are now offering telesessions.
No, I didn't.
Really?
Yeah.
Little clinics. It's brand new development. And, of course, you know about these kind of novel innovations, Talkspace, BetterHelp. These are all in the category of to be understood, in my opinion. That is to say, I don't have an opinion about them yet. They are novel and involve chatting and seeing somebody through a televisit at your local pharmacy. Well, is that fragmenting? Is that promoting access? Like, I think we don't know, but it speaks to the fact that the market has appreciated the supply-demand mismatch, and people are trying different things. So I do think it's hard to get in to see a therapist. Many people have reported to me the therapists are so overwhelmed. Whenever I talk to a practitioner, I say, just say on your voicemail, you're overwhelmed with work, because I think it's to call 10 people and not get a call back. It's not a commentary on your suitability for help. It's simply a commentary on the intensity of the supply-demand mismatch.
You know, I want to go back to the telehealth thing or the phone session for a minute. I guess I was celebrating it, and I still do, as another way you can get access to what you, kind of care you need. The flip side is, I was just thinking, Marjorie and I were talking on the radio, I don't know, a week or so ago, about how much better interviews are when we're physically in the same room with the person we're interviewing, because you can read body language and they can relate to your body language and all the, you know, all the obvious kinds of things. What are the downsides of not having a patient who needs help in your physical presence?
Well, I think we have a pretty good literature that that is to say video-enabled sessions, are effective. And we already knew that before the pandemic. which is why the field was able to pivot in really 4 days. I mean, the metal system is among the slowest moving machines on Earth. The idea that it could pivot in 3 days, because there was a very strong literature on that. I think the music of being with a person is just kind of indefinable. I know a practitioner who sees patients throughout the winter on his porch with heaters, because so many of his patients liked to see him.
Yeah.
And he had kind of a three-season porch and put a heater on and had the windows opening and made the best of it, right? And so are there things that could be advantageous? You get to have a little insight into the dog, the kids, what's in the refrigerator if you're doing medical visits for, you know, diabetes checks, right? It's an interesting new development, and I would say we have to learn from this. It helps a lot of people, but I don't think it's great for everyone. Kids with neurodevelopmental disabilities, people who are paranoid of technology, I don't think it's magical. It's a different vehicle, and we're going to keep learning about it. NAMI's doing a survey of thousands of people, and one of the questions I wanted to make sure we got into the survey, what was their experience of telehealth? So perhaps if you have me back on the future, you know, I could tell you about that, because we have big data set coming about the experience of access and the experience of telehealth, because this is, there's a lot we don't know.
Ken Duckworth, I want to talk to you for just 1 second about this languishing thing. I love the this article in the New York Times by Adam Grant talking about people that had trouble concentrating. They're not excited about 2021. Instead of bouncing out of bed at 6 o'clock, they're lying in bed playing words with friends. It wasn't mental health, really, in a sense. It wasn't depression. It wasn't hopeless, but people felt joyless and aimless. In other words, they were languishing. Which is where a lot of us may be who aren't, as I said, depressed or anxious, but just blah.
Yeah. I don't think there's a DSM diagnosis for languishing blah. And my Words with Friends game is way up in the pandemic. And
oh, yeah?
I take pleasure in that. And, you know, I will confess to having done it during a bad meeting on occasion. So it is what it is, right? So people have lost structure. They've lost human connection. They've lost so many of the things that make kind of bring the life in music to life.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean everybody's clinically depressed. And I think that's important. You know, we're going through something and it is, you know, adversely impacting people's quality of life. So now the sun is out. And so are you outside? Are you getting a little vitamin D? You're able to walk with people that are vaccinated now, and I know the restrictions will continue to lift. I think we're learning a lot about how much we need connection. To me, that's one of the big takeaways, is how much we need each other. And that's been the thing that has been really taken away from people. And so I think languishing, feeling blah, is part of the loss of structure and, you know, the loss of ordinary social contact.
You know, speaking of connections, I'm told that you've made a connection with Prince Harry and Oprah. And could you tell us?
The connection is remote. Yeah, they're
Remote is better than nothing, I would say, Dr. Duckworth. What's your Harry and Oprah and, I guess, Apple TV connection there?
Yeah, so Prince Harry and Oprah made a decision to do a series on mental health. And they invited me because I'm kind of from the regular guy school of mental health. And, you know, I'm interested in how ordinary people function and, you know, try to put a life together, how you integrate sort of the medical model of care or psychotherapy and building a life worth meaning. And so I've been consulting with this. They're interviewing remarkable people. And some of them are world famous that you wouldn't necessarily know live with a mental health condition. And some are quite ordinary. And I think the series, I think it is out this Friday, is you know, going to be another effort to make it okay for people living with mental health concerns. It's not really based on the pandemic. A lot of this was shot before the pandemic. This was, I think, 3 years in the can. But the pandemic slowed everything down. And I was fortunate to be able to see all the episodes. There's some incredible footage about international experiences of trauma, people who are in the training for the Olympics, living with major mental health concerns, superstars, athletes who are out about their vulnerabilities and what that has meant to them. So I signed a lot of papers that say I can't talk about who's in this. I think I give up a kid if I mention anyone. Mm-hmm. But all I can say is they've attracted some remarkable stories.
Great. Yeah.
And this is the me you can't see. Is that what it's called?
The me you can't see. Great. It's Apple TV. I think it's coming out this Friday. I think it's about 5 hours. It's 5 episodes anyway. And I feel they did a really good job.
Terrific.
Oh, good.
Can you just do me a personal favor? I've left like 15 messages for Oprah, and she has not called back. So next time you two talk, can you put in a good word?
Next time I have her over for coffee, she's hanging out with me. I consulted to them. But anyway, yeah, that's the most common question is, can Oprah come to my book club? I have no idea.
Well, if I had a book club, I'd want her there. Dr.
Yeah,
Duckworth.
Exactly, of course.
As always, we really appreciate your time and your perspective. It's great to have you.
I'm so honored that you continue to take an interest in mental health. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Dr. Ken Duckworth is Senior Medical Director for Behavioral Health at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts and the National Medical Director for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thanks again to Dr. Duckworth for joining us. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest political headlines. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. Joining us online to go over the latest political headlines is CNN's John King. John, of course, is their chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics. Good afternoon, John King.
Good afternoon. Busy day.
Hey, yeah, busy day on lots of fronts. Let's start with Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's opposition to this commission looking into the riot on January 6th at the Capitol, because it's not going to include Antifa and BLM protests. Is that the reason?
That is it in a nutshell. Yes. He authorized a Republican member, one of his deputies, to negotiate the deal. The deal was negotiated. The Democrats actually gave a lot in those negotiations from where they were to accept some of the Republican positions, and then Kevin McCarthy said, never mind. He says it's because, you know, we're not going to explore other political violence in the country like BLM and Antifa. The commission, number one, if they thought it relevant to their work, actually could do that if a majority of members voted for it, but it would start as a January 6th commission. Look, this is about power and, in his case, a personal conflict of interest in that he has decided that he's going to make amends with President Trump and former President Trump, and that is their way to victory in 2022. Kevin McCarthy would be a star witness for this commission, Marjorie. He spoke to then-President Trump that day, and he told several colleagues after that it devolved into a shouting match and that the president told him the rioters clearly cared about the election results much more than he did. So, you know, his testimony would really give us a lot of insights into the mindset of the then president of the United States at a time when people were asking him to, you know, send troops, send help, make a public statement for the rioters to go home. He would be a witness. And he doesn't want to do that because it'll anger you-know-who, and it might cause problems for Republicans politically in 2022. And their end-all, be-all is getting power back in the House and the Senate.
You know, and so why did he hang out his colleague? Is it the Republican ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee? Why did he hang him or her out to dry if he knew at the end of the day he wasn't going to buy in? Is this because Donald Trump hadn't told him what to do yet?
It is a great question. And reporting from my Capitol Hill colleagues, and we have an extraordinary team up there, and I've seen this in some other places as well, is that he didn't think the Democrats would agree to what they were asking for. And I think that, you know, the part of it was that there are no members of Congress on this commission. It's an independent commission like 9/11. And, you know, Speaker Pelosi had originally proposed that there be some members of Congress. Her view at the time was our building was attacked. We were attacked doing our work. But the Democrats gave ground on that and said, sure, if you're talking about if we can get credible, independent people and they have subpoena power, then fine. You know, I'm not saying there wasn't any politics or contention involved in that, but they did cut a deal. And our Hill team says they gave in to several of the Republican requests. And then McCarthy said, never mind. you know, the, or at least does day, that he didn't think they were going to agree, and now he has a rut-row on his hand.
We're talking to John King. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Can I ask you a quick question off this? Obviously, there have been many Democrats who've sold their souls for politics and done disgraceful, hypocritical about faces on any number of issues. But the one, what amazes me really is that Kevin McCarthy and Representative Stefanik, I think that's how you pronounce her name, who used to be a moderate, normal Republican and now has gone total Trump. I mean, even among their own members, they seem to be in extreme cases of flip-flopping and just they look so ridiculous. I mean, to me, but do they not look ridiculous to the people that are there? I guess not, because they just replaced Liz Cheney with Stefanik, and she's going to be the number three person. So this is craziness, it seems to me.
Well, you've heard me say this before, but I'll say it again, that in my view, 30-plus years doing this, the cancer in American politics is the way we draw House districts, that they're not competitive. And so Democrats and Republicans don't have to talk to people across the aisle. They have to worry about the next primary to keep their seat. And so this does manifest itself, sometimes in Democratic politics. But at the moment, the big issue is Republican politics. And I think often we have these conversations about moral equivalencies. There should be no doubt here. If you believe attacks on courthouses are wrong, they are. They are. If you believe violence during demonstrations by anybody is wrong, that's true. And so if you want to come forward with evidence about Black Lives Matter or Antifa or anyone else and say, I want to talk about this particular – now, there are criminal cases against some of these people in these courthouse cases. You can raise those issues if you want. But let's not draw a moral equivalency of reprehensible events at demonstrations and other, you know, attacks on buildings around the country to a sustained attack on the Capitol of the United States and, in fact, the United States government on a day they were trying to certify the results of the Electoral College and officially make Joe Biden the president-elect of the United States after a rally. This is not, you know, these are not apples and apples. These are completely different events. This is a fundamental challenge to democracy, and Republicans are trying to make it about, you know, well, that was Tuesday's bowling match. Let's focus on Wednesday's bowling match. No, and it can't be allowed, and a lot of people have to say, oh, you're just being partisan. No, I'm not being partisan. I live in this town, number one, and I know a lot of people who work in the Capitol, whether it's cafeteria workers or police officers or members of Congress. They were at risk, and for Republicans to try to broad brush this, It's beyond the pale. You guys should listen to the sound if you haven't. You were probably on the air. Jim McGovern, son of Massachusetts, at a House Rules Committee meeting this morning, went ballistic, my term.
He did.
Was just like, look, listen, people, this is ridiculous. We need to find out the answers here, and there is no excuse. And in his view, if you don't want to find out from an independent commission, just like after 9/11, what happened on that day, Chairman McGovern said, you're not fit to serve in this building. There's a lot of tension between the House Democrats and the House Republicans over this issue, and this is going to boil for some time.
Talking to John King. So, John, we'll do this briefly, since less Trump the better, but I'm watching one of the incredible television moments. I'm watching your station last night, and the Republican, I think he's the guy who does overseas ballot stuff in Maricopa County called the Recorder. What's his job?
Yes.
Okay, so he's on, again, the Republican. And whoever the host was, and my apologies to him or her because I can't remember what show it was, reads a, it's not a tweet anymore, a posting from the former president in which he writes, the entire database of Maricopa County, the largest county in Arizona, even I know that and I'm not John King, the entire database of Maricopa County in Arizona has been, capital letters, deleted. And then whoever the host is, in this out-of-body moment, ask this guy who runs the Recorder of Maricopa County, what was your reaction when you heard this? And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, it was a pretty odd experience because I was sitting in front of my computer looking at the voter database from Maricopa County when somebody, a Republican, who he said was a wonderful person, Vicky, I think her name was, texted or emailed him and said, why is the database of Maricopa County been deleted? Can you explain this to us mere mortals, John King?
Yeah, Donald Trump is still lying.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
And there are a lot of Republicans who are still enabling. Jim, this is, you know, and again, people out there roll their eyes at this, and I understand the people who get mad even when we talk about Trump at all. If he was saying, you know, if it was trivial stuff or not relevant stuff, I would agree. I mean, he's a former president, and, you know, when toddlers have rants, we don't put them on television or talk about them on the radio. But this is about, this is a fundamental attack still on institutions. It is a fundamental effort every day by the former president to undermine trust in fact, trust in truth, trust in math, trust in democracy, and trust in institutions. And I don't care how you vote. This is bad. This is dangerous. It is a corrosion in the system. And that so many elected Republicans are willing to have these fraudulent audits or still question the results of the 2020 elections, we have a process in this country. You file a recount request. You file an audit request. You can go to court. They did all that. Mm-hmm. And they lost. If we don't have an end, if there's not a rule of law and a process, then we're lost. Then we're done. And there is a rule of law. There is a process. 70-plus judges, including a bunch of Trump-appointed judges, essentially laughed these cases out of court. I'm sad I have to keep talking about this. And so the people out there who say, well, don't talk about it, I wish I could agree with you. But when he is attacking the foundation of everything we have and people still support him and he's planning a comeback, we have to call it out. We just have to.
I think you're totally right. We're talking to John King from CNN.
So, John King, the Supreme Court with the newly appointed Amy Coney Barrett, who's been very pro-life in her previous dealings, courts and personal life, is going to face this abortion case that would about, I think it's out of Mississippi.
It is.
It says that 15 weeks is the limit for getting an abortion. What are the politics involved here?
Well, I mean, there's policy and politics, and they collide in interesting ways because of the timing. They're going to take it up in the next term. We never know where the court is going to go, but we do know for a fact it is a more conservative court, without a doubt, and we do know for a fact that Professor Amy Coney Barrett, before she was on the bench, was anti-abortion in her views and questioned Roe. Well, that doesn't mean she will carry those into hearing the case, right? We have to give her the benefit of the doubt until we go through this. But there's no question you have a different court now without Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the court. And with Amy Coney Barrett instead, the math of the justices is just different. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, said in his own confirmation hearings that, Roe has established precedent. That doesn't mean you don't erode it in some ways or change it in some ways, but the fundamental underpinning of Roe was safe in the old court. We don't know if it's safe in this new court. We just don't know. So we're going to have to watch this case go forward. And there are a lot of, pro-life Republicans who either want to eliminate Roe or significantly chip away at Roe, and they believe this is the vehicle. We will watch what the court does. That's the policy. The politics are that there are a lot of Republicans, even pro-life Republicans or anti-abortion Republicans, whichever term you prefer to use, who can do political math and who think if this happens in the 2022 midterm cycle, it's risky for Republicans because they've already, there's majority support for abortion rights. There is varied polling on what are acceptable restrictions. And prior Supreme Court cases have said that Pennsylvania case, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, that you can have some restrictions on this right. So this could open, though, the whole debate about choice and how that factors into political turnout in the midterm election year. That's a possibility.
Well, I know you're not a constitutional lawyer, but to quote Marjorie Egan, a question for both of you, has there been a major right granted the American people in the last X number of years
that
either by a court, a Supreme Court, or by legislation that's been taken away? By the Supreme Court?
Voting rights.
Well, that's a good one.
Fundamentally taken away? That's a hard one. I'd have to study that one. Again, the Planned Parenthood versus Casey did say that states can adopt reasonable restrictions. You can look at some of the gun control decisions, whether it's the Heller case by Justice Scalia, where challenging D.C.'s total ban.
Yeah.
You're right. You're, in terms of fundamentally saying something that exists, we're wiping it out completely? I can't think of that in recent years anyway. I think this is a giant challenge. And again, it is a test of the new justice. There are a lot of people who think Justice Kavanaugh will actually be the swing vote here. If Roberts stays with the whatever you think about Roe v. Wade, whatever you think about Roberts' position is viewed widely as whatever you think about any issue. If it's been the law of the land for 25 years, we're not going to turn it on its head. Right, that it's society has now accepted that this is the way life is. We're not going to turn something on its head, whatever the issue. If that holds still, then Kavanaugh, if everybody thinks they're right about Justice Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh could be the swing vote here.
It's almost 40
well, you
years,
know,
isn't it?
Yeah. You know what's interesting about this, too, is that you look at polls and people want Roe to stay, and I think it's about 60% in most polls. People that want an outright ban is much lower, 20-25%. But there's this mushy middle, as Globe columnist Ellen Goodman used to call it, of people who don't want it gotten away with altogether. But, you know, they talk about, well, viability 24 weeks in 1973 is probably different than viability in 2021. And they may not be so opposed to weeks at which you can have an abortion. You know what I mean?
Well, I do. And I always think, I want to preface this by saying, I think it's always dangerous for men to talk about this issue.
Yeah.
I just do, because I believe this is a conversation that is best had among women, whether it's just women in the public or women in politics. But look, it's just, if, again, set the issue aside, there have been dramatic advances in medical equipment, medical technology, medical capabilities on every front, right?
Yeah.
The issue is. And so, yes, and that is what a lot of these states, that's what these, a lot of what these states are talking about. To that mushy middle part, I miss Ellen Goodman.
She was a great columnist. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. The mushy middle is that, you know, there's some, depending on where you're, how you phrase the question, and in different parts of the country, you know, parental notification or parental permission, there are, you know, the numbers get, when you ask specific, you know, questions, the polling numbers do move around a little bit. There's broad, you know, majority support for the basic right for a woman to make that choice. There are some differences when you go through some of the particulars, and we'll have to see how this case plays out.
You know, when you said the mushy middle, having nothing to do with this conversation, the first thing I thought of, and John, I don't know if you'd left Boston at this time.
Oh, gosh.
Kirk Scharfenberg was the editor, late Kirk Scharfenberg was the editor of the editorial page of the Globe. He wasn't the editor then. He was on the editorial board then. And he writes an editorial about a Jimmy Carter speech, and in the interim stage, not ready for the paper yet, and obviously there was no internet at that time, he titled it "More Mush from the Wimp," meaning a pathetic speech by Jimmy Carter. And unfortunately, what normally happens is that headline, which is the preliminary one, just to move it along, became the headline in the newspaper. Do you remember this, Marjorie?
Certainly do.
And it made it into the newspaper. So mushy middle reminded me of More Mush from the Wimp, even though I am a great admirer of the Wimp, I should say, Jimmy Carter.
If Jimmy Carter was still president, I was in Boston, but I was in my teens. So I may not have read that editorial. I may have been doing late teens too, so I'm guessing I would have been at the Great Boston Latin School in those days.
That's right, the Great Boston Latin School. So John King, you must have been a very smart kid, John King, make it into that Great Boston Latin School. Absolutely.
Donald Trump helped me take my test.
Okay.
Because he couldn't take his own, is that what you meant? Yeah.
So I mentioned voting rights before. I'm reading where in the Senate, despite some indication of support from Joe Manchin, that the voting rights bills are imperiled.
Well, Manchin wants them to pare it back. He wants them to go to a smaller version. He does not want to deal with some of the campaign finance changes. I pick up on their language. You say campaign finance reform. Well, reform to one person is horrible to something else. So sometimes we use their language. And, again, to try not to take sides on the issue, the Democrats, you know, they public financing piece in part of the House bill. And Manchin is no. That's not going to pass. He doesn't like it anyway, but he also says it's never going to pass the Senate. So he wants them to pare it back and says if they pare it back to make it about voting rights, he's willing to do it. So this is still, to me, a TBD, one of the many TBDs about big issues on the Biden and Democratic agenda. You know, where are you willing to compromise or trim things back or cut things in two or three and say, let's vote on this piece, and then we'll come back to the pieces that are more controversial. But this is going to be a giant test for the president, I think, when we get through. He is trying right now to focus. He's at a Ford plant today where they're making the new F-150 pickup truck, the electric version. He's trying to focus on his North Stars, you know, green energy, the economy, COVID relief, you know, economic help to people. But he's going to have to wade into these issues. You know, the Israel thing is front and center for him right now. Being president, you know, to borrow an old phrase, who knew it's complicated. You know, he's going to have to do lots of things, but he's going to have to referee some fights in his party down the road. He's been trying to wait to get a little more, I think, hoping the economy comes back, get more political standing, have more leverage in those fights, if you will. But that's coming.
John, it's a pleasure. As always, and yes, we know the Red Sox are the best team in baseball. You don't have to tell us. It's perfectly fine.
I'm going to visit the greatest city on this planet Memorial Day weekend. I'm so looking forward to it. I haven't been able to travel, and I'm coming home for a couple of days. I'm bringing my little boy. I'm so happy. It's going to be great.
Hey, you going to a Red Sox game?
Yeah,
are they home that weekend?
What's the deal at Fenway?
I am indeed. Yes, I am.
Don't go away. How do you feel about 35,000 unmasked fans in Fenway Park?
I think if people are getting their vaccine shots, that's fine by me. I've had my vaccine for a while now. I think I feel, you know, I always think some of this stuff is psychobabble. I just feel safer. I feel better, right?
Yeah, me too.
I just do. So I hope people get the shots. And I've had it for some time, and I'm still nuts, but I'm doing fine. So everything's okay.
Well, welcome back to town, John. We'll be glad to see you. Take care.
John,
we'll talk
King.
To you soon.
Thank you so much. Okay. John King joins us every week. He's seen as chief national correspondent and the anchor of Inside Politics. And we always love talking with John King. Coming up, we're opening the lines. We're just talking about Fenway Park with John King, asking you, are you ready for a return to air travel?
No. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking me. My apologies.
Well, you can weigh in too, Jim.
Thank you.
We're also weighing in to our listeners here at 877-301-8970, BPR, WGBH.org. You're ready for TSA screenings, baggage fees, long lines at the airports, and fights about mask wearing in the eye. Forget the overhead baggage. It's the masks that are getting everybody going now. We're going to ask you about how you feel about airlines. Keep it down, 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For over a year, we've been doing everything we can to avoid airborne pathogens. Now are you ready to be airborne yourself? The return to pre-pandemic living also means the return of air travel, but it looks like everyone is a little rusty from the pilots. Did you read that New York Times story?
Yes,
about
from
how
the
they
pilots.
We'll get to it in a second. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have digressed. They've forgotten how to do just about everything except how to take off to the passengers, as Marjorie said, who can't be bothered to keep their masks on. The incidents of unruly airline passengers are soaring. Pilots who have been laid off over the past year are now in rigorous retraining programs. And after a year of not flying, are you asking yourself, why start now? The number is 877-301-8970. Or are you eager to get back on an airplane? Do all the inconveniences that come with air travel not seem worth it to you anymore? Or are you dying to go to some faraway place? Christopher Muther is going to be with me tonight, travel guy for the Globe. He just went to some Turks and Caicos kind of tiny little island with like 1,000 people living on it. The likelihood of me getting a plane, I believe now all the middle seat exceptions are gone, meaning people sit everywhere, even though you have to wear a mask. I am so unready to get on an airplane. Would you get on an airplane right now?
No, I would not.
Okay, well, that's the end of that discussion. And how do you feel? You know, this story from the New York Times. Do you have it in front of you, by the way?
Which one, about the pilots or the unruly passengers?
The pilots. Read the first paragraph to people a little bit about what they can't
do. Apparently, one pilot lost control of the aircraft during landing, skidded off the runway into a ditch. Another one, and these are people, pilots have been furloughed. They have not apparently been allowed to practice flying during the pandemic, or they haven't done it. This other guy forgot to activate a critical anti-icing system to prevent hazards and cold weathers. Others flew at the wrong altitudes. But the basic problem here, I guess, is that it's not like riding a bike, as the headline says. That you can remember how to get the airplane off the ground into the air. That's good. But apparently what fades is the operational sides of things. And the only way to stay sharp and constant, according to this piece, is to keep flying. So these pilots, let's hope, are having some practice before they get you back up in the air.
Can I tell you something? I want them to do well. I'd love to get on a plane and all that sort of stuff. And I am fully vaccinated, as we've said 1,000 times. How would you feel when you sit down on a plane and the guy or woman sitting next to you takes their mask off?
Well, listen to this. This is one of the stories of an unruly airline passenger. This was a woman who was traveling from the Dominican Republic on a JetBlue flight to New York City, refused to comply with instructions to wear a mask, hurled an empty liquor bottle that almost hit another passenger, threw food and shouted obscenities at flight attendants, grabbed the arm of a flight attendant, hurt her arm, struck the arm of another flight attendant twice, and scratched that crew member's hand. The flight had to return to the Dominican Republic. However, the fine recommended for this woman was $32,750. And I don't know if she paid it, but that was the fine that they recommended.
Did Marjorie Taylor Greene pay the $70,000 or she did? 877-3.
Can you imagine getting into a fight with her?
Threes, no, I'm not getting in a fight with her. Let AOC deal with her, which she's, I guess, doing.
And then,
877-301-8970, yeah.
There was the state senator from Alaska that, as you may know, was suspended from Alaska Airlines, Laura Reinbold, because she was captured on video arguing with employees at the Juneau airport about mask rules. So they
tell the end of the story. She now has to drive to work in the Capitol. It takes her 12 hours because she's banned from Alaska Airlines. Jessica in Rhode Island, your first simple question. Are you ready to resume air travel? Hi, Jessica.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
Unfortunately, I have to fly next Wednesday. And my husband is pretty laid back about everything. He, of course, we're both fully vaccinated. He's going to wear a mask. And I bought a face shield. And he said that if I wore the face shield on the plane, he wouldn't sit with me. So,
that's a great one.
We're very different about sort of hygiene and things. I'm super, you know, and he runs around not really worried about stuff. So it has put a little bit of stress on our relationship this week, and I do have anxiety about it, but I think if I just mask up and...
Hey, Jessica, but I don't know if I'd wear a shield, but I have the exact same feeling.
I think you're kind of cool looking.
You do. You and I and Marjorie are all fully vaccinated, and we know the likelihood of coming down with anything is very small. And even if we got it, the likelihood of suffering is infinitesimally small. Again, I feel exactly like you do. What's aggravating you about the whole thing? What's making you nervous?
I think just knowing that there could be other folks on the airplane that are not vaccinated, or where is this plane coming from that I'm getting on in Logan Airport?
Yeah.
You know, what kind of germs are floating around on it?
I'm
a germaphobe, so unfortunately my husband is not, and it's going to be an interesting sight.
Well, I hope you wear the shield. Stand up to him, Jessica. We're on your side on this one. Call us when you get back and let us know how it went. Jessica, thanks for the call. I mean, I understand intellectually all of the protections I now have that I didn't have before, and I know what my odds are, but I'm not a germaphobe, but I'm pretty much where Jessica is. I really would not want to do this, particularly if somebody next to me was mask-free.
Yeah, well, Paul says he's waiting for the flight pilots to get the airline pilots to get back up to snuff. He's not interested in flying with student drivers. I get what he's talking about. Absolutely.
Kim in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Long time, first time.
Thank you.
Nice to finally get on. And I just booked my flight last night to Tuscany. It's been 2 years since I've been there, and I'm looking forward to going back. I'm fully vaccinated. I've got great friends over there, so I can't wait to get on a plane and get out of town.
Well, and when you said September, did you purposely do, what is it, June, July, August, 4 months from now, because you figure things will be more settled and safer and all that, and the pilots may actually know what they're doing by September? Is that what it's about?
Partly that, yes. But I also, I typically go over there in September anyway, but that's also one of the reasons why I'm waiting until September, and then I have a chance to cancel if, God forbid, something happens and they start ramping up with cases again.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm really envious because there's no place I'd rather get on a plane and go than to Italy. So have a great time, and thanks for your first call, and stay in touch with us, Kim. Thank you so much. I mean, as much as I don't want to get on a plane, when you heard her talk about going to Tuscany,
did you
not say to yourself, is that heaven or is that heaven?
You know, I think it's all about where you're going. If you're flying to Newark, New Jersey, then maybe it's not worth it. But if you're going to go to someplace really great, then you could see where you might get into it. Lisa says she just came back from California. It was great. Cove says he's been on 8 flights so far this year. The air is super filtered, safer than the grocery store. If you don't want to fly, don't fly. But he has no problem with it. So, I think it's your risk the level of risk you're willing to take.
Well, I think the risk, but see, that's what's weird about this with me. I think the risk level is really low. It sounds like the airlines are doing the right thing about air, that they are requiring masks, and those $70,000 scoff laws are the exception. It's just, I don't know, it's just the queasiness about the whole thing. I'm just not...
Well, I don't like to fly, period. If I could take a train everywhere, I'd go on the train. I'm
taking
not
a train
flyer.
In Tuscany would be really be a great. Long
it
would trip, take, you know?
A long time, you know, if no one's built a tunnel to go across the Atlantic,
be,
unfortunately. Yeah, you ever go in that tunnel thing?
I haven't, but I really want... Have you?
Yeah, yes.
Have you?
Yes, and it was great. I mean, it's a little nerve-wracking because you're underwater.
Is what
right.
we're talking
yeah.
about, obviously.
Because before that, they had the boat train. Remember, they had the boat train? You had to get on the boat. They put the train on the boat. Yeah, that's how you get to like places like Sicily a million years ago. Anyway,
Michelle Quincy,
thank you for calling.
Hi. I just got back from Vegas yesterday.
Oh. And?
Yeah. One of my best friends got married, and it's the first time my husband and I actually – honestly, like, left the house in about the year and a half. My husband was high risk. We both got vaccinated. The first time we went out to eat, the first time we really did anything was off in Vegas, actually.
Wow.
So you just went wild, Michelle, in
Vegas. How was that for both of you?
It was very weird. They actually lifted their mask mandate about halfway through our visit there. We were there for 5 days. And also with my friend, I told him that I wouldn't go unless I was fully vaccinated. With the timeline in our state, it had to be the Pfizer vaccine, because I told him I wouldn't go if I got Johnson & Johnson, and that Moderna, it would have taken too long, and like I was lucky enough to get the Pfizer vaccine. So the plane, we bought the third seat, and you know, it wasn't that bad. I think that, you know, we stayed masked the entire time. We didn't have anybody on our flight, mm-hmm. like the stories you were sharing earlier. I'm terrified of flying anyways, but, you know, on the way back, they talked about how often they filtered the air on the plane,
yeah.
And kind of what they were doing. It was a newer plane, and we did direct flights.
Michelle, did you say you bought the third seat?
Yes.
Boy, if you can afford it, that would assuage my concern. I think that's brilliant if you can afford it.
Did you go to the casinos, Michelle?
Yep, we did.
What was it like in there?
When we got there at first, most people were wearing their masks. Most people were wearing their masks correctly. And by the time we left, probably 25% of people were wearing their masks because they had lifted the mandate.
Yeah.
So the casinos changed their signs as we were there saying, like, unless, you know, you must wear a mask too. If you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask. But, you know, if you're not vaccinated, you do.
Well, I admire you. After not being out of the house for that long, to break the ice with a trip to Las Vegas is pretty bold. Glad you're well. Welcome back. Hope the wedding was good. Michelle, thanks much for the call. 877-301-897. You ever been to Las Vegas?
Yeah. No, I have not been to Vegas. I've
Hell
been to
on
Reno.
Earth, by not the way. And yeah. I know people love it. And I know some people, it's their only vacation. They go there. But some people only go to Disneyland or World or whatever the hell it's called. That's another hell on earth. But that's for another day.
Laura said she just flew to St. Louis and back on Southwest, sat next to a couple from New Hampshire, and their baby, none of them wore masks.
And how did she feel about that?
She says she's fine. She said they
wait a second.
You know,
how can they do that? They're required to wear masks, aren't they?
Well, she said they didn't have any masks on.
That's troubling.
Yeah.
Okay, Karen in the car, you're next. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, you guys. I love you guys. So
thanks.
I'm happy
Thank
to be
you.
On.
We're happy to have you. What's up?
My quick story is I got COVID last year in February. My company has a gigantic convention. It was in Dallas, and I don't know when I contracted it. I did see a couple of teenagers goofing around wearing masks, but it was before there was any real inkling that this was going to go like wildfire across the country. So anyway, I got COVID from that trip and spent 2 weeks suffering at home and then a week in the hospital, and thank God I didn't get it so badly that I had to be on a ventilator. But I am very loath to get back on an airplane. I think I'm right in the same camp as Jim. It's not that my brain doesn't understand that there's, you know, safety, that it
right.
seems safe now. I'm fully vaccinated and everything. It's just my gut. I was so sick. I just can't even imagine getting back on an airplane unless I absolutely have to.
So when you say February, you mean February at the beginning of this whole thing?
Yeah, February 2020.
Wow. Well, wow. I think you've got a good excuse. You have a better one than I do for not wanting to get on. If I were you, I would really not want to get on it. Karen, boy,
yeah,
I'm glad you're well, Karen.
And yes, especially at the beginning, Karen, because at the beginning they didn't really know what was going on here, right? And there was a lot of confusion about how to treat it. And gosh.
Did you change jobs, Karen, or no?
No, I'm still working for the company. But when I was in the hospital, they tried to get me a COVID test, and the state wouldn't release it. They didn't have any tests, so they felt that my symptoms weren't severe enough to warrant getting a test.
Oh, God, and you're in the hospital.
That is unbelievable. Where was this again? Did you tell us?
Okay.
Where was it?
Oh, I live on the South Shore of Boston.
No, but where was this that this happened?
Oh, Dallas.
Dallas, okay.
Well, but it could have been in the airport. It could have been any of millions of people I feel like I came in contact with.
Well, yeah. Stay well. We're glad you're better, and we're glad you called, Karen. Thank you much for the call.
Well, of course, most of us were all running around oblivious until the 10th or 11th of March, right? Wasn't that?
When did we start wearing masks also? Do you remember when we started wearing masks?
It was a long while, because what we used to do is come into the studio. We didn't have any masks on. We're cleaning everything, disinfecting everything,
right.
Remember?
Because we all thought it was contact stuff, right?
Yes, we're scrubbing everything down and breathing all over each other, unknowing that about the mask yet.
Well, I was politely chastised by our former boss, because I wasn't wearing a mask in the building early on. I think to the credit of GBH, they urged, not urged, I think they required masks early.
But remember they were saying then...
I may have been a scofflaw in the beginning. What?
Remember they were saying then that we need to save the good masks for all the medical people?
I do,
and you
the
can
N95s,
get the little cheap
yeah.
masks and all that kind of thing. Wow. It went really quickly. Okay, do we have time for one more
no,
call?
No, we don't.
No,
Marjorie.
We don't. I'm sorry. We don't have time for one more call.
The show's over at pretty much the same time
every
day. I was
so excited
you know
about these
mean?
Calls. I know, but I was going to try to squeeze somebody in really quickly. But
why don't you give
him
your cell
now.
Phone? You can talk to him after
okay.
the show yourself.
Ha, ha, ha. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by our national security expert, Juliet Kayyem, our medical ethicist, our captain. I can't wait to see what he thinks about the CDC and its seeming turnaround. Joe Manaki in the Globe kind of said... Oh, the CDC is really flubbing it. Anyway, we want to thank our crew.
Yeah, amazing piece, yeah.
Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker, the one who helped us way back when. Well, helps us every day, actually. Our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. What's on TV tonight, Jim?
Well, Renee Landers, who's a constitutional law expert, among other things, at Suffolk University Law School, is going to join me to talk about what we talked to John about, John King, a few minutes ago. What does it mean that the Supreme Court takes this case. We'll talk about worst case scenarios. And by the way, a lot of people will be protected in some states where a constitution protects the right, like Massachusetts, but other states not so much. Chris from Muther will join me. He has another perspective on travel writer for the Globe. He just got back from that island that I can't think of the name of, somewhere in Turks and Caicos. And then I'll be joined by a couple of people involved with something that's a newly renamed the Latino Equity Fund. We're going to talk about how Latinos have really suffered here, and we know it, but we'll plummet a little bit in terms of both the economic consequences and the health consequences of this year-long nightmare and what they think is the road out. So that's all tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston.
Tom just emailed and said he was stranded on the runway in Houston because of bad weather for 2.5 hours. He was listening to our show, Jim, and he said everyone on board was well-behaved and they were all wearing masks. So there
you
go.
That's because they were all listening to the show. I mean, it causes a lot of people to act well. I'm Jim Browdy. See you tomorrow.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you have a great day and hope you can tune in again tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.